Members will call the meeting to order. We have a quorum. And since we have a quorum, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes. So moved by Representative Benson. Any questions, corrections? Seeing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, and the minutes are approved. Members, quick roadmap. We have a lot of bills to go over in the next couple of days, and today in particular, I know there are some events that some people would like to get to, so my goal as chairman is to try to get us to that point rather quickly so that we can meet that timeline for people. We're enforcing, because we need to get through so many bills, we're going to enforce a kind of strict timeline, not to block legitimate debate, but to kind of limit it so that it's focused. I think we're allowing a half an hour per bill. And so that is inclusive of time to present the bill and then equal times for opposition and in favor of. So that is our path right now. Remember, oh my, now we have audio. Very good. So Representative Falk, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 928 be recommended to pass, and we'll move that to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's a pleasure to be
placed on the General Register.
Be before your committee.
Welcome.
House File 928 was brought to me by some of the publicly owned nursing homes in my district, and essentially for them to put forward a local match to draw down additional dollars, the timelines didn't quite line up between when the levy was set in the case of a city-owned facility. And so even if they wanted to apply for the additional drawdown, they couldn't put up the local money because the levy had been set in place. So this bill aims to correct that by allowing them just a little additional time to, if the city so chooses, the county so chooses, to go and put forth additional local money for them to be able to apply and access those additional federal dollars. That's about all I have for it. There are some other people here. I believe there's one person from the department if you have more detailed questions, but that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it.
Thank you, Representative Falk. And just to the testifiers and audience, if there are people wanting to testify for or against a bill, I'd appreciate it as it's being presented if you could come up and kind of sit in the back there so we can move people forward to the testifying table quickly. So are there any people to testify for or against this bill? Did the department want to testify, as Representative Falk indicated, or I'm not seeing anybody making a big move. So members, questions? Questions on House File 928? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 928 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 928 is passed and moved to the General Register.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That might have been a time record as far as getting a bill passed. So
thank you, Representative Falk. He yields the balance of his time to the next. Representative Lanning, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 979 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Lanning, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 979 is a reform proposal to the Reform Committee. Members, over the years, we've had individual asset limits that have been established on a wide variety of programs, and they've been done one at a time as the issue has come forward. What's happened is that we've got a very complex system, difficult to understand system of asset limits. Very complex, very difficult sometimes for counties to be able to sort out all the different limits and what might be applicable to a particular situation. There is obviously a need for some limits that make sense, but we also believe there ought to be some real consistency. And it's important also to keep in mind the need for people to be able to build their assets. The co-authors on this bill are folks, Representative Hosh, Representative Fritz, Representative Szymanski, and I are all a part of the Ladders Out of Poverty Task Force. And the task force is following up on work of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty. And one of the things that the commission report tells us very clearly is that if we want to help people work their way out of poverty, we have to let people accumulate and build some assets. That you're not going to be able to get your way out of poverty if your assets are not allowed to grow. And therefore, by being too restrictive when it comes to asset limits, we're actually working against the ability for people to work their way out of poverty. And so, members, we are asking the department through this bill to do a study of these asset limits to see if we can't bring about some consistency and uniformity to make it easier for counties and others who administer to understand and implement. And also keeping in mind that if we are keeping people from working their way out of poverty, we're working at cross purposes, it seems to me, with our asset limits. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we have a couple of folks who would like to testify on this bill, and I would ask you to recognize them at this time.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Lanning. And I want to thank you for your work, your leadership on the Ladder Out of Poverty Task Force. Appreciate you bringing the bill forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Services Advocacy Project. We represent low-income families across the state. And just very briefly, we support this bill. We're really thankful to Representative Lanning for bringing the bill. This bill does a couple of things. Representative Lanning laid it out well, but in your packets you have a chart, I think, that Legal Services provided you, and it shows what the asset limits are across public benefits programs. And over the years, what Legal Aid has found is just that there's incredible complexity across these programs. I won't go through these charts, but you can tell even down to whether or not an engagement ring counts or doesn't count as an asset is different across 12, 15 programs. So we think it's a great idea for the department to look at these asset limits, to make them consistent, to reduce some of the administrative burdens for counties, and also make it easier and easier to understand for families what counts and doesn't count. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a coalition of nonprofits, faith-based organizations, and individuals from across the state of Minnesota. We advocate for effective anti-poverty policy, and we believe finding effective policy means looking closely at data and experience and research to identify what really works. That's why we like this bill. We like that this bill starts with a stage of analysis to look really closely both at Minnesota's experience and other state experiences to find out what would be a reasonable set of policies that would reduce administrative cost, make the public assistance programs we have more effective. To Representative Lanning's point, some data we've looked at that did a study of low-income households in the United States between 1984 and 1994 looked at households that were both low-income and low-wealth, had little to no assets. Of the households that were both low-income and low-wealth, 10 years later, more than 60% were still poor. Families that had low income that had started building some assets, only 40% were still poor 10 years later. We think that's a sort of long-term policy thinking that could help Minnesota get the most out of its public assistance programs.
Very good. Members, any questions to the testifiers or the author of the bill? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lanning. I've often thought that this is an area that we needed to do some serious policy listing, and I'm glad that you're willing to tackle it. But I'm hoping that we will also give the department some discretion to have some differences, because I think there are justifiable differences. I have in the past, for example, carried a bill and didn't bring it forward this time because it would have a fiscal note, but that would allow, for example, a difference in asset retention for seniors who are living in their own home. Typically, and I think most of the testimony that I heard was really more focused on younger people, families, that sort of thing. When we have seniors who have to spend down to an asset limit of $3,000, if you have your own, I mean, many seniors who are vulnerable and who actually have had vulnerable adult reports filed against them are unwilling to get to that level of poverty because they know that is not enough to replace the furnace if that were to go out or to deal with the roof if the roof is getting old. And they so cherish living in that home that they'll put themselves at risk and not seek the supportive services that they would otherwise be eligible for. And I've always felt like we should allow people who are not into situations where we are actually picking up their housing costs, but are actually paying that out of their own resources, that we ought to give them some ability to retain the resources that you need to maintain a house, as opposed to someone else. But then you have other situations where people might buy a vehicle even though they're not driving, just because that's a place that they're advised, that's some place that they can, you know, put resources, and then they could sell the car and fix the roof if they needed to. And, you know, so you get kind of convoluted thinking in these programs, and I'm hoping that as the department goes forward that the directive to them is really seen to use common sense and to figure out what will enable people to actually maintain maximum independence and at least cost to the public good while you're looking at this. Because I think particularly when you look at persons with late life disabilities and seniors is where you start to run into some policies that maybe affect people differently than when you're in that family and an asset building stage of life.
Representative Lanning?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I certainly would interpret this bill that the department has the flexibility to recommend where it does make some sense to have some differences. We're asking them to take a good look at this and get it to be consistent and more understandable than I think the whole system has right now. And so I think our intent is to give the department the kind of flexibility you're asking for.
Thank you.
Members, other questions? Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to touch on a few things in this area, because oftentimes we like to use examples to make our political points at times, but you know, and the asset limit is one of them. Oftentimes we hear, well, you know, so-and-so has bought this or did this or whatever it may be to show examples of why we need to make cuts. But I want to point out that many of these asset limits, most of them, are lower than what the income exclusion is for a car. And how do we, I have consumers that I work with that can't even save up for a car because the asset limit is lower than what a reasonable car would be. If you want to buy a $4,000 car, you can't do that with a $2,000 asset limit. And many individuals don't have access to credit, which we also have to recognize. And we know that reliable transportation is an absolute necessity, especially in greater Minnesota when it comes to obtaining consistent employment. And, you know, I've got examples in which I've worked with people who, for instance, one of my consumers has an annuity that comes in every 5 years. And her dream was to be able to pay for her daughter's wedding that was coming up. But because of our asset limits, couldn't do that. It's just, so I applaud Representative Lanning for looking into this, bringing some reasonableness to our asset limits. Hopefully, as committee members, we can educate our colleagues about how asset limits affect those long-term decisions in order to get oneself up. And we always say pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. Well, this is part of giving individuals boots to pull themselves up with. So I hopefully a good product will result from it.
Good comments, Representative Hosh. And I would point out, I mean, these kinds of proposals are coming forward in a nonpartisan way, which I think is great. You know, to see these kinds of things being addressed in that manner, I think is very appropriate in our legislative body, probably something we don't see enough of. Members, discussion, other questions to the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 979 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 979 is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Representative Lanning, and testifiers. Our next bill is House File 122, Representative Davids. Welcome to the committee. I will move House File 122 with the recommendation that it pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Davids, welcome to your bill.
Mr. Chair, it's not a good sign when I come to the committee to agree to the budget.
It's even worse when we don't have them either.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 122 is a bill that was brought to me by some local dentists and the State Dental Association. The main purpose of this bill is to give dentists at least some protection in the contracts they sign with dental plans. Nearly every dentist...
Representative Davids, if I could interrupt you briefly, we have an A1 amendment I think you might want to put on before we go to the bill.
That'd be great, Mr.
Members, you have before you the A1 amendment to House File 122. Representative Davids, do you want to speak to the amendment? I'll move the amendment.
I would have Mr. Spazzetto, who's going to be testifying further on the bill, describe what we're doing with the amendment.
Very good. Mr. Spazzetto, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dominic Spazzetto. I represent the Minnesota Dental Association. The amendment changes some of the terms in the proposal before you that were pointed out to us by a health plan, and it also adds some language to make sure that what we're doing is not a problem with alterations created by state or federal law. And then finally, the bottom, we're deleting line 7 to 12, which was a controversial provision of the bill that attempted to define fraud and abuse. It was pointed out to our attention that is already in statute in a different location, so we didn't want to conflict. So, Mr. Chairman, these are mostly technical cleanup amendments.
Okay. Questions to the amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? And the amendment is adopted. Representative Davids, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill provides some due process for dentists that are subjected to unwarranted audits by Delta Dental. Dentists individually do not have the ability or wherewithal to deal with these large insurance companies. The Minnesota Dental Association is a professional association. It is not a union, and therefore cannot advocate for fair dental contracts because of antitrust concerns. The only way these contracts can be altered is through the legislative process, and that's why I'm here today seeking support for House File 122. I'd like to introduce Dominic Spazzetto to the committee, and if he could make a few remarks with more details on the bill, then I have a couple other testifiers also.
Mr. Spazzetto.
Mr. Chairman, and Dominic Spazzetto, representing the Minnesota Dental Association. I will give you a brief run-through of the bill, and then we have a couple other testifiers that will speak to specific aspects of the legislation. The first three sections of the bill relate to contracts between a dentist and a dental plan organization. They require contracts to be renewed at least every 3 years. Now, for most dental plan contracts in the state, they're considered what we call evergreen. They're pretty much are never renewed. Once you sign it, for example, when you come out of dental school, you can sign a contract and not have to ever renew that contract again. The contract states that you'll be a participating provider of whatever plan that you agree to, and in many cases, the plan is governed by rules and procedures that are adopted by the dental plan organization. So the contract itself, although those procedures and rules are amended, the contract itself is a one-page document that's not changed. The section also requires notice of significant changes in the contract to be made prior to the effective date. This is consistent with similar legislation that was passed by the legislature for medical providers. I want to be very clear. This bill relates to dental plan provider contracts, not medical plan provider contracts. That's a completely different set of statutes and a different issue. But to be honest, contract renewals may not have any effect upon contracts with some of the more dominant dental organizations in the state, such as Delta Dental Plans of Minnesota.
However, we've been told it's necessary to have contracts amended to assure that the changes in the law that we are seeking will apply to those existing contracts. And since the contracts are never renewed, we have to make sure that they are renewed in order to make sure that these changes are consistent with what's happening with existing dental contracts. Section 4 of the bill relates to post-treatment audits. At this time, these audits are mostly conducted by Delta Dental, and I'm sure most of you have heard about this from your local dentist and probably from Delta Dental as well. Just for background, for many years, Delta Dental employed something we called prior authorization. A patient would come to a dentist, say, for a crown. The dentist would take an x-ray and develop a treatment plan. That information would be sent to the dental plan, in this case Delta, and then Delta would review that information, approve or deny it, determine whether it was covered or not, and then tell the patient what their responsibility was and what the dentist expected to be paid. Several years ago, Delta decided to eliminate this prior authorization. Since 99% of the time they agreed to what the dentist had proposed in the treatment plan, it was felt that this was unnecessary and a waste of money, and everyone went hooray. Shortly thereafter, Delta instituted what's called a post-treatment audit program, and the MDA feels there are aspects of this audit that are inherently unfair. Section 4 of the bill would give dentists more protection from these one-sided audits. Now, I want to be very clear, we're not seeking elimination of audits. We think that a dental plan, any insurer, has the right and ability to audit if they suspect fraud. We only want greater protections and a bit of due process for the dentists who are audited. Dr. Flynn and Mr. Affitt will explain more about this in a few minutes. Section 5, the final section of the bill, relates to services that are not covered by the insurance plan. This section is not aimed solely at Delta Dental. It applies to other insurers, some large national companies that restrict reimbursements for dentists on services that are not even covered by the plan or paid for by the dental plan. This section of the bill is legislation that has national scope. It's been advocated by the American Dental Association across the country, and I'm pleased to report that it has passed in 20 states so far. I want to be clear about how this works because it's a very confusing issue. It basically would prohibit plans from placing in their contracts provisions that restrict a dentist from performing services not covered under the plan and requiring dentists to discount their fees for those types of services. Non-covered services include things like teeth whitening, caps, some orthodontic treatment, and most all the procedures that are referred to as cosmetic. The language also relates to services when a dental plan provides no reimbursement for that service. Some plans restrict how often you can have a service done, like cleanings or performing procedures on the same tooth. There are limitations in contracts on how often you can perform a procedure on the same tooth. The plan pays nothing. The patient is responsible for that treatment. This would also apply when an annual maximum has been reached and the dental plan pays nothing. Many dental plans have annual maximums of $1,000 to $1,200. When the dental plan has paid that amount on dental services for that particular year, they pay nothing for any further dental treatment. The Dental Association considers this issue a fairness issue and is seeking legislation to prohibit dental plans from requiring fee discounts on services for which they pay nothing. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my comments, and Mr. Offit is prepared to discuss Section 4.
Very good. And as he's coming to the microphone, any questions at this point, members? Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, and thank you for having me today. My name is David Offit from the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. Prior to joining Winthrop, I worked with the Attorney General's Office from 1995 to 2003, 2 years clerking and then practicing for 6 years. While at the Attorney General's Office, I represented the Departments of Commerce and Health and the state of Minnesota in various consumer insurance and healthcare enforcement matters, and I continue to practice in those areas today. I'm here today because I have represented many, many dozens of dentists and clinics that have been subjected to third-party payer audits, and the most prominent of which is Delta Dental audits. I want to be clear that the MDA fully supports all third-party payers' aggressive pursuit of actual fraud and abuse. But I don't want you to be fooled. That is not what these audits have been about. and they have been about retroactive re-adjudication, Monday morning quarterbacking, and second-guessing of the dentist's diagnoses. If these audits were truly about fraud and abuse, we would have heard of at least one instance where the criminal authorities would have prosecuted these alleged fraud feasors, but we have not. Nothing in this legislation in any way limits a third-party payer's ability to pursue aggressively actual fraud and abuse. Nothing in this legislation in any way limits or impacts a third-party payer's ability to perform fair and reasonable audits. Nothing in this legislation in any way conflicts with any state or federal law. And if anybody tells you differently, tell them to prove it. Tell them to provide you with an actual statute or rule cite, not some general reference to a federal law or state law that has no bearing to the issues at hand. All that this legislation seeks, the fair auditing provisions, is a level playing field, balance, and fairness for those dentists who are audited. And frankly, I'm a bit surprised that there's any resistance to any part of this fair contract or fair auditing provisions. Why would anybody oppose additional fairness and process in such important matters? Now, turning to the specific provisions of Section 4 of the bill, this section of the bill and these provisions seek to address specific problems that many dentists, if not every dentist, have witnessed over the course of their dealings with third-party payers, and specifically Delta Dental. For example, including in the audit results claims that go back 8 years, 10 years, and in one recent case, 15 years, or claims that relate to dentists who used to own the practice but have been retired for many years and have no bearing on the audit results. Unfair use of an improper use in violation of the contract of mathematical extrapolation, which was not allowed by dental contracts. Not allowing dentists reasonable time to respond to the audits. These are simple, fundamental examples of due process protections that need to be afforded to the dentists. They are not radical concepts, and we urge you, encourage you to support House File 122. And for more specific examples, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Mike Flynn.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Dr. Michael Flynn, and I've been audited. I'm not fraudulent, nor am I evil, but I've been audited. I want you to know what I look like, what an audited dentist looks like. And then I'm going to tell you briefly who I am, a little bit of my story, and then the conclusion, and I'll try to wrap it up in 3 or 4 minutes, Mr. Chair. I'm a practicing dentist for about 30 years down in Lewiston, Minnesota, which is in southeastern Minnesota. I see over 1,200 Minnesota healthcare patients at my practice in Lewiston. They come from nine counties. They refer, dentists refer patients to me. Last time I checked, there's 87 counties, so I cover about 10% of the state. So I see a lot of Minnesota healthcare. In 2002, they created something called Critical Care Provider, and I've been a provider since its inception. So for 8 or 9 years, I have been treating patients under Critical Care Provider. Due to my audit, though, I have decided not to accept any more new patients from Minnesota Healthcare. I will continue to treat the 1,200 patients of record I have, but I no longer have opened my doors to new patients on Minnesota Healthcare. I found the audit incredibly unfair, incredibly unfair. Because of the distance that my patients travel, nine counties. I have patients from Faribault. There is an SOS clinic in Faribault. However, because of timeliness, they weren't able to get in. But I saw them. Travel time is very costly. So one of the things we try to do at our practice is we treatment plan for efficient care. Obviously, if they're going to travel a great distance, we want to do comprehensive care with minimal travel time. Because I did that, My average fee charge per patient visits exceeds the average fee charge per patient visit in the state of Minnesota substantially. I feel fully justified in doing that because I am not your average dentist. That isn't how we run our clinic. That's what triggered my audit, I'm very sure. When I went through my audit, the diagnosis of reviewing, well, 50 patients, 3 years, I can't tell you how many procedures. I know that the patients that were drafted were not randomly selected, simply because I treat 40% children, and of the 50 records, there was only 3 children on the audit. Incredibly unfair. I tried to stick with what I feel is the standard of care. I've done a great job treating the Minnesota healthcare patients. But the whole process, I was completely threatened by the process. I felt I had no choice but to pay them so that I could still keep my practice, my employees, and still treat my patients. Most importantly, I still can accept Delta Dental patients as they're the dominant dental insurance company, the administrator of Blue Plus, which covers over 50% of my patients. So if I am to treat them, I have no option but to sign a contract. There is no option not to sign a contract if you treat patients on Blue Plus. That's not an option. In settling with Delta Dental, I refused to sign a gag order that was presented to me. I wanted to have the opportunity to tell my story and to prove the audit process. I am sad that I have no other alternative but to decline new patients in Minnesota healthcare. I felt like I was doing society and the government a service by working hard to treat low-income, elderly, and handicapped people. I have worked very hard to reach out when no one else would do what I do, treat these people. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Norton?
Yeah, I just want to follow up a little bit, just to be perfectly clear. Dr. Flynn has testified before when we were dealing with access issues in the state, and he is one of the good guys that takes Minnesota, I mean, he kept talking about the Minnesota Health Plan. We're talking MA patients. He's one of the doctors who will take those patients, and they come from all over because no one else in our communities in those 9 counties can take them or take them on a timely basis. And I just want to make that really clear so that you understood he is one of those critical care providers that we need. He does serve an underserved population, and this, as he said, is just one additional burden for someone who takes some of the toughest patients sometimes who may delay the need for care for a very, very long time. And when they get there, they may have a higher level of need than someone who goes every 6 months for their checkup. And so because of his willingness to do that, again, it triggered an audit. And, you know, and now the state of Minnesota is the loser. Our MA families and our people who need dental care are the losers in this. So I just wanted to be really clear that everybody understood what population we're talking about. This is one of the few doctors that actually covers them. And I want to thank you for your bravery and coming forward to testify about this really serious issue.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, knowing that area that you're covering and that there have been, you know, issues with meth use and some of the repercussions, are any of your patients, suffer from the dental repercussions of that use, and were any of those part of the audit?
3 of my 50 patients were recovering meth addicts.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, can you expound upon what additional dental issues that they have that might cause an abnormal bill?
Well,
Dr. Flynn.
Thank you. First of all, their dental needs are just devastating. And the 3 patients that I'm thinking about were in their 20s. What you do is you're trying to salvage a person not only from their addiction, but you're also trying to improve their image so that when they recover, they are presentable back to the public. So uniquely, I always had to figure out a dental plan that would fit the need and uplift them to their recovery. And most of them, when they come in, were so embarrassed about their teeth, it lowered their esteem, and they had 101 other issues. And I assured them at a dentist, as a dentist, that they came to the right place because it was my job to make them the best person I could, and that and my job was to help them not only with their dentistry, but their feeling about themselves. So yes, they have a very high need for dental care. It did require a lot of extractions, which was another area of my audit, and we don't have time to go into all that today. So it's a very difficult group of people to work with, and it takes a unique dentist and a dental team, I might add. I have an excellent dental team. I have two hygienists, four assistants. Two of them are restorative function assistants. And I want to assure everybody in this room that it's not Michael Flynn talking here today. I hope I represent my entire dental team. And my entire dental team took the audit very personally. They felt very threatened by it as well. This isn't about the doctor only. This is about the team. So I don't know if I've answered your question, Representative, but I hope I did.
Okay, members, we have two other testifiers. If Joseph Lally and Bob Johnson could come down to the testifying table. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Joe Lally. I'm the vice president at Delta Dental. The vast majority of dentists in the state are honest, hardworking, highly educated professionals. And we don't have a problem with the vast majority of dentists in the state. In fact, the number of audits we've done in 2009, we did 20 audits of dentists in 2009, 23 in 2010. This is not a problem that affects most dentists. I can't speak to the details of Dr. Flynn's experience. My understanding is that in his settlement agreement, there was a confidentiality order or confidentiality agreement. If Dr. Flynn wants to waive that, we'd be happy to provide the full committee with details of the conclusions of the audit. But I'm not here to talk today about Dr. Flynn's audit. I'm here to talk today about the bill. And the bill, in our view, unnecessarily raises administrative costs by requiring recontracting of dentists. When Mr. Spicetto talked about if a dentist comes out of dental school in 1975 and signs up with Delta Dental, that dentist may still be in our network today. But that dentist has at any time an option to provide 90 days notice and to withdraw from the network. We heard that you have no, if you're a dentist practicing in Minnesota, you have no option but to contract with Delta Dental. There are 3,950 dentists, licensed practicing dentists in the state of Minnesota. 2,895 participate with Delta Dental. And of that amount, to respond to Representative Norton's question, 1,540 of those participating dentists see public program patients. In addition to that, because of our market share, which is not 82%, which has been bandied about over the last several weeks, it's 42% according to the National Association of Dental Plans, we have relationships with providers, with dentists in communities who say, well, I'm not going to participate in your public program network, but if there's some kid in our community who needs dental care, put me on the list of people to call. And so we can we do that. In fact, Representative Norton, in 2009 and in 2010, 100% of the people on public programs administered by Delta Dental who called in asking for an appointment, we were able to find an appointment for them, either in-network or with one of these dentists who will cooperate with things. We think it increases administrative costs. We think it hamstrings unnecessarily the fraud and abuse audit requirements that we have in our contracts. We think it interferes with private contracts between an insurance company and as I say, highly educated dental professionals. They do have a choice. More than 25% of dentists in Minnesota don't participate with Delta Dental. And these contracts also, we've heard that they're exclusive contracts. If you participate with Delta Dental, you can participate with any number of other insurance companies, and you most likely do. We think the bill presents fiscal issues for both the state in terms of cost and lost revenue. The costs include the recontracting that I mentioned, and lost revenue includes recoveries that would be prevented by this bill associated with both self-insured state employee plan and with the state's public programs. I just mentioned to Commissioner Jessen that in a case, the largest dental fraud and abuse case that we've had in the state of Minnesota, was settled in the middle of March with one clinic who mostly did public program work for more than $3.5 million. $2.7 million has just been forwarded to the health plans, to the health plans that contract with us, and that money will be coming back to the state. That is lost revenue that would not be able to be recovered according to the very strict rules in this contract. The notice requirements, we give notice requirements of 90 days. The bill requires 120 days. We give an opportunity for discussions. We have a full process internally for dentists who have been subject to audit. But as I say, it's 1%. It's 1%. All monies that we recover are returned to either self-insured groups or to the state of Minnesota. And the state of Minnesota employee plan is the largest beneficiary of that. So we're opposed to the bill.
Mr. Lawley, if I could, if you're looking, and I'm maybe the author can correct me if I'm wrong here, but we're not. This bill does not oppose auditing. But if you're in fact looking for fraud and abuse, what percentage or what number, what raw number of cases have been referred to state or law enforcement authorities for follow-up investigation?
We from time to time refer cases that involve solely fraud to law enforcement authorities. We have a patient fraud or member fraud case that's with the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Diego right now.
Do you have a number?
Do I have a number? I don't have a number. No, I don't have a number. We resolve most of our cases. Most of our cases don't go to litigation, and we resolve most of our cases. Our job is not to act as the cop or to punish. Our job is to act as the fiduciary for large groups for whom we administer dental benefits, as I say, like the state of Minnesota and the state of Minnesota public programs, like Best Buy and General Mills and Target and 3M and 17 of the Fortune 500 companies based in Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lally, a question regarding the subsection 7 of the bill, which has to do with payment for non-covered services. Thoughts on that particular area? My understanding is that currently any non-covered services from a dentist to his patient are subject to the price, the fee that is set by Delta Dental. So I'm wondering, why is it that you would interfere with the relationship between a dentist and his patient in dealing with non-covered services? That should be between the patient, in my opinion, and the dentist. Why? What say you?
Representative McDonald, it's not a practice that we at Delta Dental currently engage in, and so I'm going to defer that to other people. But we think it's an interference with the contract. It's not something that we currently do. I think it's important to remember it, and Mr. Spicetto and I agree on at least one thing, and that is that the non-covered services issue is a complicated issue. From our perspective, you look first at whether the service is covered, whether it's a service that's on the schedule, and the most common would be a cleaning, and most contracts have two cleanings a year. If you go in for a third cleaning that year, it's a covered service. But the second question is what it's reimbursed at, and while it's a covered service, it's reimbursed at zero, because it's subject to a frequency limitation of once every 6 months or twice in a calendar year. In that context, we believe that that's still a covered service. It's just not reimbursed it's reimbursed at zero. In terms of another example of what's a non-covered service, I think Mr. Spicetto gave good examples: cosmetic things, crowns that are not for decay or fracture, but crowns that are for cosmetic reasons because of a discoloration. That would be a cosmetic issue, which is not covered under most dental insurance contracts, and that would be a non-covered service over which we don't have any contractual jurisdiction with dentists right now. But other plans choose to do that. Now I'll let Mr. Johnson speak to that issue.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And I represent some of the smaller players in the marketplace that, as we have this discussion, maybe just three brief points, Mr. Chairman and committee members, in terms of House File 122, and we do oppose the bill. I think the question that was raised at the end, one of the issues that always comes up in the healthcare marketplace is what can we do to increase competition, to get more sellers of the product, to give employers in the state more choices. And frankly, some of the provisions of this bill deal with issues that I would describe as smaller market share players used to compete in the marketplace. So in other words, if a insurance company and the dentist will enter into contracts with them to provide discounts on non-covered services, they voluntarily choose to do that. They surely are not doing that because of some market muscle of small players in the marketplace. They're voluntarily choosing to do that. And those companies can use the provision, those benefits, if you will, of the contract to help compete in the marketplace. So whether it's the discounts on the non-covered or discounts for services beyond the benefit maximums, that section of the bill that specifically prohibits that, I think our common request is that why not let the marketplace, if the parties voluntarily choose to enter into those contracts, let them do that. I think this limits some of those choices, and I think it's a negative, if you will, on the ability of smaller share market companies. The companies I represent in the health insurance marketplace have diminished through the years, and there used to be more and there are fewer year by year. And I know in talking to employer groups regularly that is a key point that they always bring up, is what can this state do to give us as buyers more choices? If small employers have many choices when it comes to their commercial auto, when it comes to their commercial property, when it comes to their workers' comp, when it comes to their general liability, when it comes to their group life, when it comes to their rattle off the coverages, and there are a multitude of options, that is not the comment when we talk about the health insurance market. So I think with those realities, Mr. Chairman, that we just believe, I won't repeat any of the comments, I think the fraud fighting and prevention issues are essential in this area. And there's good information out there. I don't have it right here today, Mr. Chairman. You asked about statistics. This state has set up in our Department of Commerce a fraud unit. It's funded by an assessment on all insurers. They do an annual report. The immediate year or the year before in that annual report, they summarize the impact of Minnesota families on insurance fraud in this state. Now, this is all fraud, all insurance, so it's not just the subject of this bill. And it put a dollar number of $900 a year, $900 a year of the impact of a family in Minnesota of all types of insurance fraud. So I think the fraud fighting issues are imperative. We need to do it. I think some of the provisions of this bill, in my opinion, and knowing a number of other areas where there are fraud fighting efforts underway, seem pretty restrictive and limiting in terms of the ability to seek out fraud. No one supports fraud. And so we shouldn't be restrictive, in my opinion, trying to get at that. The two-year look back, as I understand, Medicare and Medicaid have a five-year look back. So, you know, we're doing something unique here that doesn't look like fraud fighting in other areas. So, Mr. Chairman, those are the points, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill has nothing to do with me, but the topic is, I've carried a number of bills on provider contracting. There's another one up on the calendar later on today. Just Mr. Lally, you've been here a long time. We've had many chats, and I've actually incorporated part of your thinking into my management of high-cost providers. But just on this matter, you said something earlier about, like, they can go somewhere else if they don't want to be in Delta. I think you carry some 80% of the insured market, or something on the order of that. You're certainly the big fish here, and you can give me the right number when I stop. But there aren't a lot of choices, and I'll tell you how the contracting works for me and whatever group that I'm trying to join. If I'm lucky enough to be allowed into a network, because many are closed, then I'm provided with a contract which is as thick as a small phone book. At least it's 20 pages long, and now you don't even know what it says. And pretty much you have to accept every word, or you're out. If I want to change one of the does, they would say, well, that's fine, but you're not going to be in the network then. And so it's absolutely not a free market for the providers. Some of the younger clinicians aren't even offered a chance to get in, which is a real problem. And so then when you're in, you have to stay in and do anything that they say. I get ridiculous
requirements from, not Delta, but from the other ones, that I have to achieve some number, which is made up. I have to accommodate some, whatever they think of, to put in their amendment. And this, the evergreen nature of some of these, if you, and you're in and it comes out and you have to abide by it, it's absolutely not a free market. If I was a Lina or a Mayo, I could negotiate. But those of us who have single practices or in groups of even 10 clinicians, there's medical clinics that struggle with this every year when they bring forward a bill, which is coming up in a couple of bills. This one came from them. It's not just the ones, but it's the tens and the 20s in a world of consolidation. And so they have to come here for relief. And the look back thing, there was a question on, I won't besmirch the name of the health plan that was doing look backs of over 3 years, charging different individuals of all healthcare types, six figures on a three-four-year look back, when they paid the money all this time with no hint that there was anything wrong. And the one I'm thinking of is known as a health maintenance organization and management. And like, well, why don't you manage then? Why don't you give us a hint that you aren't happy with the work that you've been paying for all along? And there are certainly high-cost providers, which I intend to try to get them back into the mainstream. But if you haven't been told by your provider, by your the service group that you're working under, that you're bad, and suddenly you get a bill after they analyze 5% of your business and then impute it times 20 on the whole book of business and send you a bill for $150,000, how on earth are you supposed to absorb that? None of these people have that kind of money. And so then you take it out over time, and they're working for free for the next 3 years just so they can stay into the network. And so I'm not sure if this bill is perfect, and I'm not sure if it should nick the smaller ones. But I, Mr. Chair, this bill should move just to create the dialogue, because without a bill that moves, no dialogue happens. At least there are times a dialogue does happen, but this creates a dialogue. And so Representative Davids is a talented author. He's inclusive and engaging, and he's going to talk to all the parties at the table and those in the room. So I urge that we vote yes on this when we finally get to the vote.
Quickly, Mr. Lally, we have three other representatives with questions, and we're a little over a half hour on this bill now. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Abler and members, Delta Dental, according to the National Association of Dental Plans, has 42, not 82% of the market in Minnesota. We have 1.8 million Minnesotans out of 4.298 million Minnesotans that have some type of dental coverage. That includes both commercial and public program coverage. We don't deny that we're a large player in Minnesota. We're a large player in Minnesota because companies who can, municipalities, school districts, unions, state government, that can choose among a lot of different carriers, have chosen Delta Dental. We have a national network, and that helps with these national accounts. Obviously, Best Buy and Target and those kind of companies have more employees outside of Minnesota than they have in Minnesota. We're already restricted. Delta Dental Minnesota can only sell to Minnesota-based companies. So we have a strong rating from AM Best. We have, you know, I think what might go to your issue is the chart that I think is in your packet, and we Representative Abler and I have talked about these kinds of issues before. This is the kind of data that we have that drives an audit discussion. When a commercial dentist whose practice is compared to other peer dentists, not to some standard that I set or some standard that a dentist in our office sets or an accountant in our office sets, but compares to actual claims data that we've processed in the same zip code or in the same, if there's not enough data in that zip code, in neighboring zip codes. So it's geographically based. And if the average dentist is doing 30 crowns per 100 patient, and this dentist is doing 93 crowns per 100 patient, everybody that comes in the door gets a crown. And then we learned that this particular dentist has just bought a machine, a very expensive machine that fabricates crowns in the office, which it might be great for a larger practice. It might be great for this particular dentist practice, but it doesn't mean that suddenly more people need crowns. And it's that kind of data, that kind of disparity that we don't see across the board. We see it in a small fraction, but it's that kind of data where we go back and we say, we think there's something going on here. Let's have some conversation about it. We've got an awful lot of process about that.
Okay, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it Mr. Lally?
Lally.
You mentioned there was 28 audits last year. Is that correct?
23.
How many of those audits or substantiated audits would be prevented under Section 4 of this legislation?
I can't give you a number of most of them. The litigation that I mentioned with the Smile Center that's been the subject of some newspaper articles and has been the largest recovery in a dental fraud and abuse public program case in the state's history would have been largely prevented. And the reasons for that are that it changes the look back time. Right now there's a statute of limitations on contract that's 6 years. There's a statute of limitations on fraud currently in state law that's 2 years that starts running from the time of detection of the fraud. So if you can conceal the fraud for 2 years under the bill, you're fine. And we don't think that's right. The other portion it would have eliminated the experts that we used. The experts that we used were from the National Association of Dental Consultants. They weren't practicing dentists. They didn't have chair time. It eliminates people who we have a woman formerly on our board, Dr. Rhonda Altum, who was involved in a terrible car accident. So she can't practice anymore, but because of some nerve damage to her hands. But she has tremendous skill. And is able to act as a consultant. It would eliminate her as a consultant. I'm just trying to see. Oh, the calculation of the repayment and withhold, which is permitted by state rule and federal rule, would not have been permitted. We would have had to chart audit every single patient. And now we found in this particular case, like the personal care attendance issue, that there was a hygienist performing so many functions, all of which were billed, that he would have had to be working about 22 hours a day and just on Delta patients in order to accomplish all those items. It's those kind of things that we think they're at the margins. They're not throughout dentistry. If we didn't have good relationships with dentists wouldn't participate with us. We think that we're concerned about the interference with private contract and the fraud pieces of the bill, Representative Posh. We're concerned that it hamstrings and limits us so much that we can't satisfy our contractual duties to our groups or our statutory duties to the Department of Human Services for public programs.
Representative Posh.
Just a couple follow-ups, and I don't know who this question is too, because I don't know if somebody on this committee can answer it, but we know Medicare fraud cases can do a 5-year look back. What does our Department of Revenue do for a look back on a tax audit?
Is there anybody here from the Department of Revenue? Anybody who could answer that question? I'm not seeing anybody jumping to the microphone, Representative Hosh, but we might want to maybe jot that down as a question we'd like to get an answer to.
Mm-hmm. And
Representative Hosh.
Actually, the author of the tax committee is the author of this, or the chair of the tax committee is the author of this bill.
For the record, the chairman of the tax committee said he doesn't know much about taxes.
we were counting the chairman would be busy.
Pretty sure it was tongue in cheek, but you know. All right,
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on this, I do think. I think there's ways to move forward on this bill, but adjust some of the restrictions. I think a 2-year look back is minimalist and needs to be addressed in some of the other things, but. I hope that the author works on some of those details as the bill moves forward.
Very good. Representative Grinhagen.
I'll pass that. The question was asked.
Great. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read the bill, I don't see that it stops audits that would detect fraud. It clearly authorizes them. It does put some limitations on the contract terms. What it does do is, though, as I understand it, is prohibits withholding payments while you're in the process of that appeal process, which to me is, when you think of it, these people are oftentimes small business persons, and they may not have the cash flow. I mean, the dental insurance company has significant reserves. They have to be in business, and they can handle a cash flow issue much more than an individual small business person or a small group of two or three dentists who might be working together. And so I think we need to to look at what the real impact of the bill is, because it still does provide for audit. And when I saw the chart that Mr. Lawley referenced, where they compared a dentist with other providers in that zip code of commercial patients, I can just tell you that long, long ago, when I was I stopped when I was in college, but I worked as a part-time dental assistant. And I worked with a dentist who had just come out of the military service, and to establish his practice and to establish a basis of patients, he was open two nights a week and 9 hours on Saturday. And by being the only provider who was willing to work nights and weekends, he got everyone who got that toothache that was driving him crazy, the persons who were working poor, who don't have dental insurance and don't have sick leave, who got home from work and called every dentist in the whole darn phone book until they could find someone who'd take someone. And I can tell you, at least over half of our Saturday work, while he got his practice established after coming out of the military and not really having a network to start with, was those emergency situations of people who were just so thrilled that there was someone open and they weren't going to have to suffer until Monday. And so if you had looked at that beginning dentist that I worked for, he would have looked terrible on this, because every other dentist on the zip code was working, you know, 3 or 4 days a week and golfing on Wednesday or whatever. They were established. They had a network of patients. And he had to start out by being the only guy around that was open and taking those evening and weekend calls. And, you know, if he'd been audited, he would have had good reasons and x-rays to demonstrate why he had a disproportionate number of people whose teeth couldn't be saved or who needed crowns because there was that much deterioration. But because those were people who didn't have other sources of care. And so I tend to think that this bill kind of does do the balance between the large insurance company and the provider who, you know, has to be accountable for what they did and who they did it, but shouldn't bear the financial risk when questions are raised, because for some of them that's really significant, especially when they graduate from our dentist schools with the kind of the loan burdens that they have right now.
Okay, members, we're 10 minutes past the half hour and we want to keep this moving. Representative McDonald.
I'll keep it very short. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Representative Abler's advice of getting the conversation started, and I've adopted that mantra in all the committees I'm on, but I'm wondering why this is at the State House, not the courthouse. This seems to be a dispute between two private companies, and I'm just not sure why it should come to the State House, not the courthouse. So I think it begs for a question and an answer.
The author of the bill has stepped back to the microphone. Perhaps you could respond. Representative Davids.
Well, as I said in my remarks, the Minnesota Dental Association is not a union, and so they don't really have an area where they can come in because of antitrust concerns and handle it. It has to be done legislatively. It's really not an option that we have.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald.
Mr. Lawley, briefly.
Briefly, we asked the same question. This is a case that was in litigation that was scheduled for trial in early April that settled in the middle of March, and we think that was the forum to resolve the disputes. And it was, as I mentioned, a collection of more than $3.5 million. And Representative Loeffler, the statute, the Minnesota rule on monetary recovery that permits withholding is Minnesota Rule 9505.2215. It also references 42 CFR 447.31, which is the Code of Federal Regulations. So in both Minnesota law and in federal law, it permits withholding and putting in escrow during the period and the pendency of a dispute.
Members, I will renew my motion that House File 122 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. Thank you, Representative
Davis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Members, the next bill is House File 1339. Representative Abler, who can move his own bill.
Yeah, I can find it. Golf is on. Let's split the difference between four.
I got the wrong one.
And members, again, we're going to try to stick to a half an hour a bill, and where we have a large number of testifiers, we're going to try to stick to 3 minutes per person on testimony to be fair. But a total of half hour per bill. And Representative Abler, I understand you also have an A1 amendment. So
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1339 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. And I'd like to move the A1 amendment. I have an oral amendment for that. It's and I'd like to move on after line 1.1, line 11, delete partner, insert advocate.
Representative Abler, my understanding is the motion would need to be amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Oh, I'll take that as a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair. I like going to GovOps.
Very good. And members, we have the A1 amendment before us.
Mr. Chair, and if everybody understands that, I think it's more clear than advocate, because this is all about advocacy. So I'll incorporate that into my amendment if the staff has that. So on line 11, the amendment would read... it'd be inserted after line 1.1, line 11, delete partner, insert advocate.
Okay, let's make sure we got
that. And then I'll incorporate that if everybody understands it. It's just technical.
Just a moment, Representative Abel. We're going to make sure everybody's got the amendment, including me, the oral amendment to the amendment. Okay, so in addition to the A1 amendment, we're replacing on line 1.11 of the bill the word partner with the word advocate, and that's being incorporated as an oral amendment into the A1 amendment. Correct, Representative Abler?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, do we understand what the amendment is?
On the A1, then.
Representative Loeffler and then Representative Murphy. To the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. I suspect the first part of the A1 amendment is to avoid the Department of Human Services saying they need someone to staff the task force. But to me, it compromises the work of the task force, who we want to really look at this and come up with a proposal that works for the diversity of providers that we have in our marketplace. And to say that the non-governmental members have to staff this and they can't be appointed until they say that they're going to staff it says to me that it disproportionately creates that opportunity for the largest of the providers and would really discourage small providers from being appointed when they are, I think, the bulk of the numbers of providers that offer these kinds of services. And you know, have you thought about that? I suspect it's about fiscal note issues rather than who can best staff these things. But it did seem unusual for me to say that you can't be appointed unless you agree to this other responsibility for which you won't get any reimbursement.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, the amendment is brought today to conform the language you already put in the omnibus. But I know that this is going to GovOps, and so you sent me a note, and I appreciate the comment, and I'm happy to talk to you about proper staffing of it and how we can make it work. So this is meant to be a valuable, friendly project that actually is productive. So I'm open to those discussions.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler. Can you just help me understand why we're changing the word partner to advocate, please, and what the difference there is?
Representative Abler.
We've had lots of discussions, Representative Murphy, on this term, which is not at all meant to be the term it could be construed as in this. An advocate is actually more clear. People who partner together to serve a client would be an advocate. I just thought it was cleaner and would create all the right kind of discussions and none of the other kinds of discussions. So frankly, it's just a way to keep it clean and focus on the point of this is a advocacy for a client, and just to make it absolutely clear, it seems like a technical change to me. So that's all.
Okay. Members, we have the A1 amendment before us as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
and the A1 amendment as amended is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I do have one testifier.
Very good. Welcome to the committee.
And if session should go past August, we won't get to have this witness come back anymore. And I'm not predicting it goes past August, but...
Representative Abler, I believe May 23rd is sine die.
Right,
just in case anybody's checking their calendar.
My testifier is retiring August, what?
September 1, actually.
September 1. So, and maybe if you could know some of the good work of this organization, the leadership it's enjoyed, you would be really proud to have the man sitting by you who's sitting here. So, anyway, I'll let him introduce himself. And
please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Chairman
Welcome.
Scott Walt, members of the committee. I'm Mark Peterson. I'm the president and CEO of Lutheran Social Service. I've been doing it for 24 years now, which is just a short portion of LSS's 146-year history. We've been working with persons with developmental disabilities for about 60 years now, so we think we're about to get it right after this period of time. We serve people from every county in the state, which means that we are a constituent of every legislator in Minnesota. So it's good to be with you all with respect to that. Our services are community-based and cover the entire lifespan. We do want to speak to the proposition to create the task force for My Life, My Choices. We have a lot of experience in our work with persons with disabilities. A year ago, as we contemplated this session of the legislature, we thought that it probably was quite important to help the state imagine a new system of supports for persons with disabilities. A system that would put the person with disabilities at the center of the work, that would consolidate funding streams, and that would allow the person with disabilities themselves to decide what services would be provided by whom and under what conditions. We think that if 21,000 persons with disabilities are at the center of it, making purchasing decisions, that we think that that population could make smarter and we believe the more imaginative, likely less expensive decisions that are being made today. So when fully implemented, we believe that My Life, My Choices would result in both better outcomes and at less expense. My perspective about services for persons with disabilities is that the system of supports that we've developed over the last several decades really is quite extraordinary. We are especially pleased with consumer-directed community supports. We think that while all that has been done in the last couple decades is quite laudable, that frankly we just need to get to the next level. So we're hopeful that as My Life, My Choices takes life, that there will be greater financial clarity and transparency, a greater decision-making by persons with disabilities, and greater independence and community integration for those persons. So, Mr. Chairman, we're really quite supportive of this proposition.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's an exciting hallmark that we even come to a time to have a bill with this title on this subject. I remember when it used to be My Institution, No Choices. And that we've come to this point, and it's exciting to see the graduates, you know, as they've come along these days in being able to recognize this. So, you know, I think we're ready for the next step in being able to move forward and recognizing that, but also even graduating out of program. I mean, the fact that we're having those kinds of discussions is a remarkable a milestone, I think, in the process of the venture that we started on years ago and to getting to this point. So thank you, Representative Abler, for bringing the bill forward, and to you as well for all your work over these years, and look forward to some good reporting here as well. Thank you.
I think I would add, this is another example of nonpartisan and bipartisan efforts to reform how we're taking care of people in need in our state. And so I too am pleased to see this bill before our Health and Human Services Reform Committee, getting different results from doing things differently. I appreciate you bringing it forward. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Peterson or to the author, Mr. Representative Abler. The bill is written to related to people with disabilities, but your testimony and the handout that we just got really, and the discussion I've had, has been really focused on persons with developmental disabilities. And I just wanted to have clarified as sort of what the target audience is, or whether you've, you know, how far the outreach is that you're thinking about on this one.
The focus is with respect to persons with developmental disabilities. I happen to believe that what's underneath this proposition has much broader application, but the focus of this legislation is with respect to persons with developmental disabilities.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first section I totally believe in, and I really do think this is an idea that needs to have further exploration and seeing what we might be able to do and how reforming the system might enable some more flexibility. You know, freedom to act as a consumer, freedom to choose to take risk as much as any other citizen, more choices throughout your life, an opportunity to work with others to manage, you know, the services and the budget you have, to live with minimal constraints, and to, I mean, I think that all works. But then I look at the makeup of the task force, and it doesn't reflect those values. Only 3 of the 16 people on this task force are persons with disabilities or their family members. And if we really do believe in my choices, my life, my ability to shape the services in my life, then it doesn't seem to me that the design of that should be done by a group with a makeup of people who don't necessarily even have any experience in life with a person with disabilities. The Chamber of Commerce is given a permanent role in it, and yet I'm not even sure that most providers of services to people with disabilities would even be able to afford to join their local Chamber of Commerce. Most of my small businesses can't, and I don't know that they bring wisdom and insight and experience to the decision as much as a family member or a person or a county. There's no counties here, even though counties have traditionally spent, you know, been a major part of helping develop service systems, and as new populations with different language issues and other things come seeking services, they've been a key part of trying to help network and build that system of supports. I just don't see even in terms of the range of providers, you get 2 nonprofit organizations, and one of which has to serve all 87 counties. That probably leaves it to 3 or 4 providers in the whole state, and the thousands of others compete for one other spot at the table. And then when you have that the task force members cannot be reimbursed for expenses related to the duties of the task force. If you're going to ask a family member or of a person with a disability or someone who's running a small group home in northern Minnesota to come and participate and to be at the table, to not even give them mileage, to not cover their expenses, really says, we don't want you. We want kind of the big guys around the table, and we've kind of just figured out who it is. And I just really think we need to rethink the task force, because I really do believe in the direction that you're going, and I think it's worthy of seeing what we might be able to do with it. But it's got to be person-centered and based on that consumer. And the makeup of this task force, to me, just doesn't fit with that. And then when you take away the supports in terms of mileage reimbursement and per diem, and you take away even staffing, independent objective staffing, not staffing that might have a potential conflict of interest, I just really feel like we're giving short shrift to what an idea that should be seriously considered.
And Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, well, I appreciate the dialogue, and you know, you did tell me ahead of time you had some concerns about the makeup, and I actually agree with you. The part I can't help much with is the money piece. But in this time when a lot of the public libraries have, you know, capacities for interacting the different human service departments, we've had multiple, you've been on some with me, where we plug into some remote county, they're having a meeting, and we can do a video conference. And so I think that luckily, I mean, I don't know what budget we have to do this, but I think in terms of who's on it, I'd like to work with you and come up with a list of some people to add and mix and match. There was one suggestion which I didn't incorporate into amendment because I didn't have the
amendment prepared on time. But I think that would be productive. It's going to GovOps, which is all about task forces, and the amendment would be certainly germane to be offered there. And if you'd help, I'd take that help. And we can even maybe have some commentary about how they would try to coordinate with interactive TV and, you know, just that they could access the pretty rich supply of that that's available statewide. And
Representative Loeffler, I'm hearing a willingness to work with you on this.
And I appreciate that. There's one thing, though, that I think we as a, and this will be an issue for government operations as well, and that is just that the recommendations are to be fully implemented without legislation, and I don't think I've ever seen that in a bill before. And so I just think we ought to have a process where we review the report, we get hear testimony from all the different people who would be affected, we enact it into law, and we move forward in harmony. Because my goal has always been to reform the system so that we can free up more dollars, we can have better outcomes, more flexibility, free up the dollars to deal with the people on the waiting list. And I'm hoping that this will go that direction. It could also go the way of capitation, in which the freed up dollars are retained by the provider, and we continue to have thousands of people on the waiting list. And I don't think that's your intent as an author, Representative Abler, but I do think we need to debate that when the report comes back.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I think that we're reading it different ways. I would like to, I mean, this is not meant to be they have a meeting with people who don't get paid per diems and then suddenly it becomes law, which would be a different kind of government than we have. So I think the deadlines are meant to spur them on, which is, if I have one theme, it's like hurry up and get going on these things. So I think you and I need to have a chat and we'll make it absolutely clear that they're just to hurry along and bring their recommendations be timely about it and actually. But I do want to make a difference in this topic. The omnibus that we passed is full of this sort of topic, and we have squandered a lot of time, and I've been in office for a lot of it, trying to push, as you have, about some of these very good improvements. So thanks for your help, and I'll look forward to it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I will work with you on the other issues, but I'm wondering if you would consider as a friendly amendment taking away line 2.12. Which is that the recommendations shall be implemented by July 1, 2013. Since we don't even know what the recommendations are going to be, I think we should remove that and have the report come back.
Mr. Chair, that amendment actually follows the intent of the author, so it's a simple clarification to me. So I would urge the, if there was some Loeffler wants to move deleting line 2.112, I'll urge members to vote for it.
Okay, members, Representative Loeffler is moving deletion of the entire line 2.12. You understanding the amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Okay, members, to the bill as amended, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think part of this has been already answered in terms of what we just did, but I also am... there was some discussion, certainly not around per diem, but I had the opportunity last year to create a task force and ran into the issue of fiscal notes and did get private funding, but I assume, reading this, it says the task force shall be independently staffed and coordinated by non-governmental appointees. There's not going to be any state funding. Is there going to be private funding for this? It's really difficult, I think, to do one of these task forces without any funding at all. I'm thinking of mileage, or it was already brought up. There are expenses that do come with a task force, as I found out, and we were lucky enough to have an outside group who did put up money. But... and this seems to be a little vague, but perhaps you have it all figured out, and I guess I'd ask Representative Abler.
Actually, Representative Peterson, there are actually numerous examples of task forces that operate without state funding and without reimbursement for participation. I know I've been on some of them myself, but maybe Representative Abler can answer that question.
Mr. Chair, the Representative Peterson, you've actually dissected my intention here. You know, we're short $5.1 or whatever $1 billion, and so even worthy ideas, I have a hard time finding money. But I think as this goes, I think if we had just had a sentence referencing they could seek private funding, and then they could use those to pay reasonable expenses of members. But
we just wanted to be clear that there's not a state fiscal note on this, however worthy it may be. And frankly, a lot of the groups that are going to be helping with this are quite eager to help. The Minnesota Chamber is eager, and Lutheran Social Services is eager, and there's buildings and businesses and lots of resources that, you know, even $20,000 goes a long ways. And so I think as a part of the community service that they all attempt to offer, they would find some way to come up with this. So we'll actually be discreet about that, or I mean distinct, and Representative Loeffler and I will find a sentence that accomplishes that, and along with our work, and we can share it with you if you like. So,
thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I've talked to some of the advocates for this particular issue, and I think it's interesting and worth looking into. We have, you know, lots of waivered services out there, and there probably are, there have been waiting lists, and then we have a different silo of ways to use and spend money, and I think we need to get it all on the table. But I'm wondering if you've considered, or if this committee will consider, this task force will consider the Region 10 quality assurance efforts that have kind of been made in this area. I know I've talked to some of the advocates about that and the Voices review that they do.
You can see
And then, so I would, if someone has a comment on that, it seems like they've been a group in our part of the state that has moved ahead with this kind of philosophy for some time and have been trying to spread it out unsuccessfully. And then I guess I'm a little concerned about Representative Abler listing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I guess I understand that you'd want a business representative of some sort on there, and you might consider being a little more generic in your designation rather than it being specific to the Minnesota Chamber, who we know has legislative agendas and what have you, as to just a business person who might bring that perspective rather than an agenda. That's just for your consideration.
Appreciate all the help, and maybe you want to comment about that.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, the Quality 10 Assurance Program from Region 10, I think, needs to be, you know, will be part of this conversation. We're really quite supportive of that effort, so I'm sure it will be front and center.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Very good. Members, seeing no other discussion to the bill, Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 1339, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
House File 1339 is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. Next up, we have House File 1087-1087, Representative McElfatrick. And Representative McElfatrick, I'll make the motion that House File 1087 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Actually,
Chairman.
To the testifying table. You're part of the committee, but welcome anyway. Please proceed.
A different view from here.
Yeah.
Thank you. There is an amendment to the bill. I would move the A1 amendment.
Very good. Okay. Representative McElfatrick has moved the A1 amendment to House File 1087. Do you want to say anything about the amendment, Representative McElfatrick? Or?
I will let my testifier, Shirley Brecken.
Very good. Ms. Brecken, if you could state your name for the record, who you represent, and then
certainly
proceed.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Nursing. The amendment that you see before you is brought to you after some discussion with an individual who was concerned regarding the, if you look at page 5, line 25, delete confidential and insert private. What the bill says now is that the FBI criminal report would be considered to be classified under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act as confidential, which is common for all investigative data. And the concern that was raised was that the individual wouldn't know whether or not the board had that report, and so the proposal is to change it to private, so the subject of the data would have access to the information as well as the Board of Nursing. All of the other ones that you see, that where it says insert felony, it moves, it's to be made clear that those crimes that are listed are at the felony level as opposed to a misdemeanor. And finally, Subdivision 8 was also added in relationship to the concern about not knowing the subject of an investigation, not knowing about the criminal background check, and it gives the individual the opportunity. The board has to tell the individual that they have the report and they have the opportunity to make any corrections or completions to the report.
Okay, members, we have the A1 amendment before us. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment, or the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative McElfatrick, to your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is an important step in the right direction for providing a safe environment for all patients. Every one of us can recognize the vulnerability of someone who is a patient in whatever setting. And it is the responsibility of the Board of Nursing to be sure that the nurses who are applying for license within the state are well prepared, that they are capable, and also that they are safe to function around a vulnerable group of people. This bill provides a framework for a complete background check for nurse license applicants. There are 34 other states that already do this in a similar format, including fingerprinting. And of these states, our neighboring states are all included as well. Within Minnesota, other professional groups are required to have complete background checks, among them teachers who also are fingerprinted in their process of applying for licensure in the state. There are protective provisions within the bill for the nurse license applicants. They can receive a temporary license to begin their work while they wait for the processing of their application. And there's also an appeal process for them if they are challenging the decision of the board. And so with that, I would like to turn the remainder of the testimony over to Shirley Brecken.
Ms. Becker.
Mr. Chair, I sat down in this chair and it was really warm when I sat down, so I'm kind of, you know, have been before the committee quite a bit recently in the hot seat, so I didn't know it would actually be the temperature. As you know, the Minnesota Board of Nursing was created by the legislature to ensure the public that individuals who practice nursing have the requisite education, skills, and ethics to provide safe, competent care. This is a significant responsibility, and the 16-member board takes it very seriously. Nurses care for people in their most vulnerable moments across the lifespan and in settings as varied as the client's home, schools, prisons, hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes. While the vast majority of nurses are safe, ethical, caring practitioners, it is imperative that the board have effective tools to identify individuals that pose a risk to patients. The board believes that crimes that have a potential impact on the ability to practice the profession safely or foreshadow how the nurse might treat vulnerable persons in his or her care should be considered as a part of the licensing decision. Current Minnesota law does not provide the board with this authority. The board relies on self-disclosure on the individual's application for licensure. And unfortunately, many applicants are, shall we say, less than forthcoming in their answers to the questions. Minnesota law does require the Department of Human Services to complete a background study of individuals that have direct contact with persons in facilities and programs licensed by DHS or the Department of Health. However, that background check is for the purposes of whether or not an individual is disqualified to work in a licensed facility, not whether the individual is eligible for licensure as a nurse. The board has exclusive jurisdiction to assess fitness for licensure for the purposes of public protection. To the extent there is overlap with 245C, it does not relieve the board of its burden to assure the public that individuals who are licensed to practice nursing are competent, ethical practitioners. I'd like to address some of the specific provisions in the proposed legislation. But before I do that, I would like to note that I know you have received a memo from the Nurses Association opposing the legislation. I have provided you with a clarification of several inaccuracies in that memo, and in the interest of time, will not include them in my testimony. However, I am certainly willing to address any questions you have regarding clarification of those allegations. Now, under this bill, all applicants for licensure by examination or endorsement, and by endorsement I mean a nurse who's licensed in another state and is coming to Minnesota to become licensed, will be required to submit fingerprint checks for a background check. Both state and federal records will be checked based on the applicant's fingerprints. Completing a background check at the time of licensure provides verification of the applicant's self-disclosure. Right now, the board finds significant under-reporting of the application for licensure. Applicants differ from licensees in that they bear the burden of proof to establish their qualification for licensure. It is reasonable for the board to scrutinize the background of individuals seeking to enter the profession of nursing. As Representative McElpatrick said, an applicant may be issued a temporary permit after the submission of fingerprints. An applicant for licensure by exam may take the exam prior to receipt of their background check results. The board will, of course, process background study as expeditiously as possible. However, during times of peak activity, there may be some delay in processing applications. Thus, the board wants to provide applicants with a process that limits time delays. And I would tell you right now that the board, once an individual applies for licensure by examination, they actually do all of it online. They apply for the exam. They take the exam online. And right now, the board licenses those individuals if they are successful and pass the exam and meet all of their qualifications within 24 to 48 hours. An applicant will not be issued a license unless the results of the we've gotten the results of the background check. The board should review the applicant's criminal history prior to that licensure to assure public protection. The applicant is responsible for any costs associated with their fingerprints and the costs of the background check. And right now that costs about $60 to $75. The cost of developing the infrastructure and staff resources to initiate and maintain the criminal background check process will be included in the board's operating budget, which is funded by fees paid by licensees. Currently, the board collects sufficient revenue to fund the cost of implementing the criminal background check. Now, in the proposed legislation, conviction of specified crimes will result in denial of licensure. An applicant denied a licensure based on conviction of some specified crimes may request reconsideration of that denial. Criminal convictions of a very serious nature will be permanent bar to licensure. What the board task force did, and ultimately the board in its decision making, looked at the permanent at those crimes that are permanent disqualification under 245C and mirrored those in this bill. All other crimes will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis as they are now for applicants and licensees. In reviewing criminal history, the board considers a variety of factors, including those listed in Subdivision 12 of the bill. The board will establish an implementation plan for criminal background checks for current licensees by a specified date proposed no sooner than 2016. The rationale for this is that the public safety purposes for requiring criminal background checks for applicants apply equal to licensees. However, currently the BCA, Minnesota BCA, does not have the capability to perform a wrap-back for non-law enforcement purposes. Wrap-back would permit the board to be informed of subsequent arrests or convictions of individuals that have been studied previously. Without a wrap-back, the board would be required to determine whether to perform background checks on current licensees only once or on a periodic basis, with the recognition that the board may not be aware of convictions that occur after or between background checks. In other words, that background check is merely a snapshot in time. As proposed, there is no immediate impact on current licensees, except those that are under investigation. And if there's a reason to believe that the licensee has been charged with or convicted of a crime, the board may request a background check with fingerprints. The bill does not require the nurse to submit to that. Any further proposal for consequences would require further legislation. This committee recently heard testimony and passed the bill for Minnesota to enact the Nurse Licensure Compact. At that time, the Nurses Union alleged some states do not have as stringent of requirements for licensure as Minnesota. The Minnesota Board of Nursing, in conjunction with all other boards of nursing in the country, are engaged in national efforts to standardize nurse licensure requirements across states. criminal background check as a requirement for licensure is one of those standards. And currently, again, as Representative McElpatrick told you, 34 other state boards of nursing require a criminal background check. Enactment of this bill would give the Minnesota Board of Nursing similar ability to assure the public of the qualifications of nurses. Thank you for your attention, and I would be available for questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions of either of our testifiers? Representative Wofler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Brecken. Is the main motivation then for this bill at this time part of laying the groundwork for your desire to be part of this national network as opposed to responding to particular situations that have arisen regarding nurses not being honest in their applications?
Sure.
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poplar. The answer to that question is actually no. The board has for some time, in fact, has been studying this issue for, I would like to tell you that it's only been a couple of years, but it's come up again and again and again, especially over time as we encounter situations in which individuals are, as I said, less than forthcoming on their application. And in fact, to that end, just about a year and a half ago, prior to that time, upon renewal, nurses did not have to answer the same questions that they did at the time of applying for licensure or reinstatement of their license, and the board added those questions to the renewal process. The effect has been, of course, that it has increased the number of complaints the board's had to deal with. Additionally, I think the important thing to recognize is that nurses are very mobile. And right now, 245C provides only a state-based, name-based check with the Minnesota BCA and does not provide for a national check. And so that's really the major reason is the concern that individuals were less than forthcoming or, in fact, answered the questions incompletely or they lied on their application. There are certainly, we also did, we ran our current database against the Minnesota BCA database and actually looked at within a certain time frame how many individuals had been convicted of crimes that had not told us that they had been on their license application. The important thing that came out of that, of course, is the realization that there were instances that we did not know about. And in addition to that, it was limited in that, as I said, it was name-based, and of course, nurses often change their name. And secondly, it did not include those cases of state adjudication.
Okay. Members, anybody else? Any questions? Yep. Representative Liebley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. And I had kind of the same question as Representative Wofler, but in addition, I'm just wondering, and forgive me if I somehow missed this, but have there actually been any public safety issues in Minnesota that would have been avoided had this been in place? And I don't just mean somebody that you found out didn't tell the truth, but actually, has anybody done harm to a patient as a result of that might have been avoided by our not knowing that? If we'd known this information.
Ms. Brecken.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, to the board's knowledge, there has not been any harm to a patient based on the fact that somebody, in fact, had been convicted of a crime and then became a nurse and caused harm to a patient.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? All right, thank you. So we have Rich Neumeister, if you would come up, please. And if we could have Twyla Braes come down to the table at the same time, and we could. I don't see Rich, so we'll allow Twyla to go first, but why don't we have Mary Jo George come down and get ready to testify. Ms. Bays. Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, state your name and who you are representing.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I've talked with Representative McElfatrick about our concerns about this bill. And, you know, for our organization, and I am a nurse, and so I've practiced for a long time as a nurse. And for our organization, this is an issue of freedom. Benjamin Franklin once said, those who give up freedom for security will have neither. And we have to look at what we're doing here as into moving to fingerprint more and more of our citizens on the basis of trying to prevent everything possible that could happen. And this is government fingerprinting of nurses, and I think it's a sad day to move in that direction. There are, of course, criminals everywhere in every profession. And the only way to avoid, not actually to avoid, crime being done, because you're never going to get there just because you fingerprint someone. There are a lot of people who are going to do criminal acts after you fingerprinted them. They're not going to, it's not going to show up at the time that they haven't been convicted, and so it's not going to be in any database when you do check. I'd like to just remind you that 83% of the public every year, except 2001, about 83% of the public has put the nurses at the top of its list as most trusted. Members of Congress, on the other hand, are down in the teens. And the only year that that was different was 2001, when firefighters were number one. And there, of course, there was a national reason for that. And so I think that this presumes criminality, and for the people who are going to give their life to care about others. And we could fingerprint everybody in every profession, in the legislature, and everywhere else in hopes that we might find out where the criminals are. But I don't think that that is the right direction to move. And the other thing that I would say is about individuals who are now working as nurses and being fingerprinted or not, is if somebody just got in and they're 22, 23, and they're becoming a new nurse, right, and they work until they're 65, well, you know, there's about, what is that? I'm not doing my math well, but we'll just say about 40 years, where they're, in the judgment of the people who wrote this bill, apparently, where they're free. They're free to have criminal acts without ever being tested or without ever being checked. So my concern is that we're moving into a brand new system, and it's not the way to move. And even if we have precedent in other professions, perhaps that is something that we don't need to have. Otherwise, we might as well just fingerprint everybody in hopes that we will find somebody who is a criminal before they, you know, before they commit. So that would be my the only other thing that I'd say in my last 5 seconds is that the consent in line 1.13 is not really a consent. It's a coercion. You've gone 4 years, 2 years to get your degree. You've put out all this money, and if you don't consent, you're in the hole, and you can't get a job. So it's really not a consent. It's a piece of coercion. And then what's the cost of this? So I don't haven't heard a fiscal note yet. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions?
Okay.
If not, Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. This is the first opportunity that I've had to be before your committee. For those people who may not know who I am, particularly those 60 new people, I am a citizen who has advocated on issues of privacy and information policy for a great many of years, and have helped you as policymakers make better legislation that affect the people here in Minnesota. I'm going to come at this bill from three perspectives. But first of all, I think it's important that here we have a bill that is going to have property interests for the citizen, for the people, but also a livelihood interest. Now, there are three things of how, when I see a bill like this, I look at. One is equity, of it and fairness of it, the duplicativeness of it, and how the bill came about. Well, let's take a look at the equity and fairness of it. First of all, right off the bat, you're hitting in a two-tiered system where you're going to be having applicants who are going to be all of a sudden doing a lot of things. So this bill, if you take a look at the end of it, is August 2012. So at the end of July or whenever, you know, if I did the day before, I could probably get my license. And we're talking about license now. After August 1st, I may not. That's an applicant. Then you take a look at the other part of the bill where for current folks, you won't have to deal until 2016 for the current folks. And I have some concerns about some of the equity aspect of it. Secondly, what the bill does, it basically takes away, particularly when they deal with the Offender Rehabilitation Act, which has been around since 1974, it basically takes away civil rights statutory legislation that functions for the citizens and the people of Minnesota, particularly when they say revoke or deny. Now, some of the concerns I have when you talk about equity and fairness is some folks talk about, let's say, for example, the doctors. Well, the doctors, for example, are from the Offender Rehabilitation Act, but it's only for sex crimes. But they have all the protections. So I have concerns about the arrest. Number two, the duplicative. Mr. Kerber, who has been before your committee many times, I've worked with him and his predecessor on doing the 245A, where 63% of the 110,000 nurses are come under background checks. I have the concerns about this whole new process and various issues on that. The third point is in regards how the bill came about. I don't think there was effective feedback from people that this has an impact on. Number two, I don't think the general public, the board, really had a give and take. It was developed basically within the board. And finally, the thing that what you can do with this bill, this is a complicated, very complex issue. I suggest you do a study, you do some kind of to include various folks about it, some of the folks that will testify here, and then come back with the recommendations. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the few moments of your time.
Thank you. Members, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, it's not uncommon for us, especially in the caregiver community, to require a criminal background check. And it's not, I guess I would disagree with Ms. Brace about criminalizing. I think, as a scout, assistant scoutmaster in a scout troop, I have a background check that's been done on me. There are a variety of people who are required background checks. So if you're not a criminal or somebody who has anything like that in your background, is there a reason to be concerned here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I look at it at this way, is that government shouldn't be asking for information I unless there's some kind of rationale or reason to where, let's say, on an FBI check, you give the fingerprints. Maybe 20 years ago, something happened that has nothing to do, but all of a sudden, the entity may know about that. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it's important that when you have a system currently now, which has been described by 245, and Mr. Kerber has been very much involved, I think that's an appropriate process. I think at least there should be some discussion. I mean, here you're setting up a situation where I get my for a license, and then at the same time, there will be another kind of license, another check through 245A. I think one of the two. I think you need to decide on what to do, rather than have two of them. I think that 245A could be done with some of the other, the other 37%. That don't go under that background check. And just one point is that there's a lot of information that will come up on background checks that are not convictions. And I have concerns about that and how the board may treat that, particularly when they will be deleted from the Offender Rehabilitation Act if they use that in a denial process.
Ms. Brecken, do you have a follow-up to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would, you know, point out to Mr. Neumeister that the bill does deal specifically with convictions and not charges or allegations. And the board would be bound by that law and could not, you know, use that information in a capricious way. Secondly, what this bill does is really fill in some gaps that 245 did not deal with. Specifically, again, we're back to applicants for licensure, not present licensees who are working. If an individual is disqualified under the Vulnerable Adult Act, the individual, the board gets notified that they've been disqualified, and so does the employer, but neither the employer nor the board know why they have been disqualified. That information is not shared. Additionally, I thank you, Mr. Neumeister, for reminding me that we've had conversation with Mr. Jerry Kerber at the Department of Human Services that, where they do the criminal background checks. This is we need to get the authority to do it for licensure and get started. Then we can work with the Department of Human Services to maybe figure out how to interface with 245 and to maybe make some changes to that in relationship to nurses. We did that a number of years ago, or at least the legislator made a change. It used to be that if an individual was determined to be a perpetrator of maltreatment, what happened was the department made a decision to disqualify them from employment. The board might have looked at the situation and said, and the example that I'll give you is that a nurse makes a medication error that results in the patient having to go to the hospital, but realizes immediately what that error was and reports it and gets the kind of help for the patient that's needed. We actually had a case like that, and the board did not take disciplinary action against the nurse's license because she did what she was supposed to do when the error occurred. However, she was disqualified from employment for 7 years under 245. That change, at that time, the Department of Human Services, along with the Board of Nursing, sought a change to the law that in those situations in which an individual might be disqualified under in that kind of a situation, that decision is now made by the board, not for disqualification, but action with the license. So that was an incremental change, and I see this as a next step in proceeding toward making the process interface well for the licensee and public safety. And just one, I would like to come back to Representative Liebling's question, because when you asked specifically about harm to a patient, what I can tell you, and I didn't think about it this way, was that there are many instances in which the board gets complaints about diversion of drugs by a nurse, and then upon investigating that complaint, finds out that the nurse has, in fact, been convicted of crimes related to drugs in the past. And if we had known about that earlier, we might have been able to deal with it, you know, sooner.
Thank you. Just a gentle reminder, folks, members and testifiers, that we're already at a half an hour, and we've got a couple more testifiers. We've got about 6 or 7 members that want to ask questions. So if we can be as concise as possible with our answers and our questions, knowing this is an important issue that we need to fully, you know, get it all out there, but nevertheless to try to be as brief as possible. Members, can we break for half an hour after this bill or and continue in meeting until we have finished hearing the bill? Go ahead. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, that's a question he just read. Somebody forwarded to him. I will. It wasn't rhetorical, I think, but or maybe it was. I don't know. I can understand the desire for a break. I do know people would like to get to something yet this evening, and I think we have how many bills yet to get to? 4. I think, Mr. Chair, maybe we could take some input from the committee on it. But my personal preference would be let's keep moving through these bills and get them done. I see another person who agrees with me. So, Mr. Chair, I'm seeing lots of nodding heads. This side of the aisle, the same. Okay. Maybe you have your answer, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. We have another testifier. A question from Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. I'm wondering if it would be all right with the chair if I ask Mr. Kerber from DHS to come down. I have a couple of questions from him.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for us, please, record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division at the Department of Human Services, where we do background studies that have been referenced earlier. And I can try and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Kerber, I'm wondering if you could tell us how this piece of legislation deviates or is different from the background checks and licensing that, or background checks on licensed professionals and other professionals that you already do.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, these background studies are a little deeper in the extent. When I start over, these background studies really kind of move upstream from where our background studies start. We do, I think I've explained it to this committee, we do over 1,000 background studies a day now at the Department of Human Services, and we're doing them on all the people who work in human services license programs, including child care centers and chemical dependency treatment programs, mental health programs, all the services for people with developmental disabilities that are licensed. And then also in addition to that, we do them for the people who work in health department license programs, including hospitals, nursing homes, home health care, outpatient surgical centers, and a few more. We do them for the Department of Corrections on the people who work in adolescent programs. All told, that amounts to about 268,000 that we did last year. Certainly some of those background studies are on nurses. I think, as you heard, an accurate representation, our background studies do not include an FBI record check on everybody. In some cases, some types of services we do for child foster care and adoption agencies, we do an FBI record check on everybody because of some federal requirements. But our run-of-the-mill, bread-and-butter background study is a review of Minnesota criminal records at the BCA and our centralized database of substantiated perpetrators of vulnerable adult maltreatment and child maltreatment, as determined by the 87 counties, adult protection, child protection, health department, and human services. When we do a BCA record check, one of the things that we look for on that record is whether or not the individual is identified as a single state offender or a multi-state offender. And so if an individual has any criminal record in Minnesota that gets reported to the BCA, there's more or less an electronic handshake done with the FBI to determine whether there are records anywhere else in the system. And then that stamp gets put on the Minnesota record. So unless somebody is identified as a single state offender, then in those cases we require the individual's fingerprints and we do an FBI record check. We probably do about 12,000 of those a year for about 260 background studies, all told. And so in this case, and we also will check criminal records in other states if we have reasonable cause to believe, and that term gets defined in our background study law. This is a little different because we do the background studies on the individuals when they first begin employment with one of our providers that's licensed. And so, as I said, this will move upstream a little bit because if a nursing home or a hospital is looking to hire a nurse, that person already has their nursing license. Well, this is before that. So this would be involved in the application process for that nursing license. So it's way upstream a little bit. And so as it makes sense, I think as Ms. Brecken mentioned, if and when this passes, it would make sense for us to collaborate and figure out, come back to you with some streamlining legislation that reduces our redundancies. No government agencies are interested in repeating each other's work these days. So we could figure out some ways to streamline both of our processes, perhaps.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber, is it safe to say then that those employed in licensed facilities are already undergoing a background check?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, they in licensed facilities, they are most definitely undergoing a background study. It's a little different background study, and I think this is a little broader because there are some nurses that aren't that are working in clinics, for instance. We don't do background studies on nurses that are employed in clinics. And, you know, school nurses maybe. I think they probably come under school background study requirements. You know, there's a lot of background study requirements out there, certainly, as you know. But the clinics are the one most frequently referenced gap that we're aware of.
And Mr. Chair,
Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Kerber.
Could you have an idea of how many applicants are disqualified through your background study process per year?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, out of the about 1,000 background studies a day, we end up disqualifying about 50 people a day. And so we last year, I think we disqualified somewhere between 10 and 12,000 people. With that disqualification, of course, comes an opportunity for them to, similar to this bill, they can challenge the correctness of our decision because the information we relied upon from their perspective might not have been accurate. But they also get to prove that or make an argument that they don't pose a risk of harm, similar to this. So it doesn't mean that 12,000 people were denied employment. It means that 12,000 people were given a notice from us that you've got something in your criminal record that's seriously problematic.
And Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you'll notice my questions are really concise. Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber, do you think it's safe to say that the system in place in Minnesota is working? I mean, do you have ideas about how you'd want to improve our background study system in Minnesota?
Mr. Kerber.
Do you have legislation proposed to do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I think I think I've reported to this committee before that we had I think it was this committee, but that we had initially applied for a federal grant, I think I mentioned that, would have required us to do an FBI record check on everybody we're studying that's involved in long-term care. We withdrew that application actually because of the ongoing costs. That there was it was a $3 million grant, but the background study cost just to the FBI alone were going to be $6 million a year, and we were thinking that this probably isn't the time to propose that kind of additional fee on providers, and we weren't going to come to you and ask for it. And so we kind of made a decision to kind of sit back a little bit on that grant. But there are, I mean, I think it's understood that fingerprint-based background studies are better than name-based background studies for a whole host of reasons. The FBI certainly would say that, and the BCA would certainly say that. So the whole issue of the questionable identity of our the person in front of us and whether their criminal record matches, you know, there's a lot that we still don't really know. Mm-hmm. And are we preventing things from occurring? Honestly, we want to believe we are, but it's hard to measure things that don't happen because of something we're doing.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much. I am wondering, Mr. Kerber, or maybe Representative McElfatrick, if you think that this is important to protect the public, should we be extending this this form of background study to all providers, physicians, pharmacists, occupational therapists, chiropractors, et cetera?
Representative McElfatrick. Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, is your question, is this providing greater protections for people?
Mr. Chair, it's probably a question for Representative McElfatrick. If this were to become the law, would we want to, from your perspective, should we extend this protection of the public to all other providers, so require the same level of background study for physicians, for pharmacists, for chiropractors, et cetera?
Okay.
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I wanted to defer to Mr. Kerber because it was broader than just nursing, and this addresses nursing alone. At this point, I don't necessarily want to say that I think it should apply to all providers because not all situations are exactly the same. When I think about this bill, I think about probably the obvious. You think about a night shift with one nurse in the unit. You think about children's hospitals with one nurse on duty at a particular time. I think about all of the possibilities that are there for one individual acting alone. Those kinds of situations don't necessarily happen with all healthcare providers. So at this point, I would be reluctant to say it should be expanded to everyone.
Mr. Chair and Representative McElfatrick, when I used to work in the operating room in Marshfield, Wisconsin, there was a urologist who used to go in the back door and do TURs in the middle of the night without anybody knowing him. So it was just one patient and one physician in the operating room alone. And that was a very lonely place, let me tell you. I would say, and this is just advice, Representative McElfatrick, that I have a lot of questions about this legislation. I think it would be wise to lay it over. And before it becomes law, work out the differences with DHS so that there is a nice knitting together of the issues between 245 and this idea, and then the contemplation about whether or not this should be applied to all providers. If it's good for the public, it should be about all providers and not just registered nurses. Thank you.
Representative McElfatrick, any comments?
No, I don't think I have a comment to that.
All right. Mr. Kerber.
I might just make one comment, Mr. Chair. I think as we've talked with the Board of Nursing here, we have been doing background studies now for 20 years. We started on March 29th of 1991. It was a major event that we might major milestone a couple weeks ago. Probably nobody noticed but us. But in our development of this and working closely with the legislature, and there have been bills every year, multiple bills to amend our background studies process, and so it gets a lot of review. One of the questions that has come up repeatedly is why are we doing these at Human Services on licensed professionals? Why aren't the boards doing the background studies? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the obvious answers that we have had all along is that, you know, that would make some sense. It would make some sense for boards to do background studies rather than having Human Services. We're regulating the provider. We're regulating the program. And where individuals must meet certain credentials to get their license, a background study is kind of a natural fit in there. But in the absence of that, we began doing these background studies and with the expectation that over time the boards would start doing these background studies and we would probably disconnect a little bit from those so that we wouldn't have that redundancy. And so this is kind of the first big push forward in that. And, you know, it's been 20 years, but it does make some sense that the boards do the background studies rather than us in our regulation of the facility and of the provider, of the employer. But it's just another perspective.
Thank you. Before we move on to our next testifier, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one comment and then two, and then a question. You know, as I'm listening, and not only listening, but reading this list, and then thinking about a conversation that I had with juvenile justice advocates, it became very clear to me that their concern was well-founded, and their concern is that so many of our young people ought to see a list like this because in their teens and during those early years, they could get involved in any one of these, be convicted, et cetera, have this on their record, and I don't think they realize that this could bar them from a profession, and so it's just one comment. But beyond that, I wonder, do all the other professions have fingerprinting? That's the one thing I know. Teachers and the educators have to go through criminal background checks, and doctors, etc. Do they all have fingerprinting?
Teachers do.
Representative.
They do. I didn't realize that. Thank you.
Ms. Brecken. Follow up. Representative Peterson. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we've had a lot of testimony on this. I'm going to offer my own observation to this. I've done a ton of licensure work in my time. And this was brought to my attention before, and I didn't read it very thoroughly, and it wasn't my bill to carry. This bill needs some work. And I don't know that we want to limit people that have passed bad checks and, you know, credit fraud. And not that those are good things, but sometimes those are not as big a deal. And I'm going to make a suggestion that we modify the motion that it go to civil law. It has to go to both civil law and health finance, I think. But also that I think we make it pass without recommendation. And so it has to come back to health finance. And I share the concerns of many of the witnesses, although I do want to say that the Board of Nursing is a highly respected group, and they just don't bring things forward willy-nilly.
And I think they're interested in the will of the legislature and in the voices they've heard, and they're going to go home and take this to their workshop and maybe shorten the list up and deal with some of the issues here. And if it hasn't met the satisfaction of the most of the members here who are on the Health Finance Committee, then I think we can go a different way with this. And I think that might make some of the witnesses more comfortable. It would certainly make me more comfortable in moving this bill out. And so that's just a suggestion. It's not my motion, but I would suggest to the author she might consider adopting that motion when we get ready for moving the bill out.
Thank you, Representative Abel. Representative McElfatrick, maybe, I don't know, do you want to respond to that? If that's your intent, we could modify the motion now, or we can do that at the end, too, when we vote on the bill. Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, certainly I think we want to get the bill in the best possible form that we can, meeting the needs that are trying to be achieved here. And so if it seems that we can get it into better form with some additional work, I'm sure that the Board of Nursing would be agreeable to that, and certainly I would be.
Okay. So why don't we change the motion now? If you're okay doing that, if you want to change the motion on your bill, that would be fine. So your motion would be to House File 1087 would be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law without recommendation. Does that?
As I understood what you were saying, okay. Yeah, and I am good with that. Yes, so I am good with that motion.
Okay, so that is now the motion before us on House File 1087, members. Next, we have Representative Barrett, then Representative Grinhagen, and then Representative Liebling. Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is for Ms. Breckman, I believe. Ms. Breckman, thank you. Is a nursing degree, is that a four-year degree?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are two levels of licensure, that is licensed practical nurses and registered nurses. Registered nurses may be made eligible for licensure by graduating from an associate degree nursing program that prepares them for registered nursing, from a baccalaureate degree program, and more recently from a master's entry program. So there are three different ways. Some states also do have diploma programs. Minnesota no longer has diploma programs.
Mr. Chair, one
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. My question, I'm not sure it applies because my thoughts are related to a four-year degree, so this might not apply, but I'll say it anyway. Regarding the effective date of July 1st of 12, that's about 14 months away. And so while I'm conscious of making sure that we don't have murderers and felons and so forth entering the nursing profession, I'm also conscious of the fact that some people are 1 to 2 years into their nursing program and wondering about that tactical aspect of them graduating only to find out that they cannot pursue their dream of becoming a nurse given their criminal background. I'm thinking more of issues related. I think Representative Al Abler, what he had mentioned, you know, those things people do in life when they're younger that are unfortunate and bad and felonious, but yet. So I'm just wondering if there's a practical aspect to the effective date in which we can not penalize these people who have been 2, 3, even almost 4 years into a program and then saying, sorry.
Ms. Parkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, I think as you look at the list of crimes, the first 18 crimes that are listed there, with the exception of 13, are all right now permanent disqualifiers from employment. So under Mr. Kerber's background check that's conducted by DHS, they may be in a nursing education program now. They may get licensed, and they may not be able to work in a licensed facility. So that same thing is occurring right now. To speak to the crimes that occur at a younger age in life, first of all, juvenile convictions are sealed. So they would not be considered in the review. Additionally, those other crimes that are listed there, the individual has the right to ask for reconsideration of the denial, and it would be based then on those factors that are in subdivision 12. So there is a provision for that. But as I said, they were mirrored exactly after the provisions in 245.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you.
Kim. Next up we have, if I'm on my list here, Representative Grinhagen, then Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, the as long as we're implementing the Representative Abler's suggestion, I will pass on my questions and see what work is done when it comes to civil law. I'm on the civil law committee, so I'll pass right now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question about what rights, what would a person do if they were denied a license under this, and then I see there's this asking for reconsideration procedure, which seems good, but then what if they're denied? Do they then go to court if they think that this is, if they still disagree, or what would be the next step?
Anybody at the testifying table want to respond to that?
I will.
Why don't you identify yourself for the record and then answer the question.
Chairman,
thank you.
Representative, my name is Renee Cronquist. I'm the Director for Practice and Policy at the Board of Nursing. In response to the question, an individual who has been denied licensure and has requested a reconsideration of that by the Board under this provision, if the Board affirmed its earlier decision of denial, the individual would have a right to appeal that decision.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But to whom would they appeal, I guess?
That would be an appeal to the civil court.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out to the committee, I'm glad that Representative Abler made his suggestion and that we're going to go that route. But I just wanted to bring to people's attention this very morning in the Judiciary Committee, we were considering a bill for veterans that essentially would say that if some, and it's Representative Bruce Anderson's bill, that says that a veteran who is discharged and has a, I'm blocking on the word now, but a good discharge from the military, honorable discharge, right, and had a previous crime, would basically have that wiped out for purposes of licensure. So I just wanted to bring that to people's attention because we're kind of maybe going different directions here, and I just wanted to put that on the table. I don't know if that's really inconsistent. Maybe it's not because there is something in here that might allow that. But that was just a specific instance that would say, since you did your service and you were honorably discharged, we're now going to give you a clean slate and kind of put the burden the other way. And we just need to make sure we know where we're coming and going on all these things. Thanks.
Thank you. Key members, we have two more testifiers and four more bills to get to. So if the next testifier could come to the podium. It's not really a podium, is it? It's kind of a table with microphones.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with the Minnesota Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity. I will be very brief. We represent about 20,000 registered nurses statewide, and primarily most of these nurses do work in our hospitals. And for the record, I do want to say that our organization absolutely supports the need to conduct criminal background checks. We think that's very important to ensure that patients are both safe and that qualified nurses are providing that care. But I think what we agree with is that we do feel that this bill is creating redundancy with the current system. So we were hoping that we would have a better understanding of the interplay between the current system and this new licensing and fingerprinting system. Because a nurse right now under our, say, working in a hospital is subject to a criminal background under 245. The employer also has to do a criminal background check. In addition, the nurse has to, in their reapplication, fill out a criminal history background. And another issue that maybe wasn't raised was the one in our licensing law that does require persons, institutions, and the court to report to the Board of Nursing any conduct constituting grounds for discipline. And so for an employer, this means they can report any action, including denial of privileges, and dismissal from employment. And for the courts, and I understand Ms. Brecken says they're not doing that, but maybe we need to strengthen that current law. It means they shall report any judgment, including felonies, gross misdemeanors, and misdemeanors. So, quite frankly, we think a lot is happening out there. We think the system is working for at least a lot of the nurses working with vulnerable adults. And we wanted to just go slow, make sure that we had better interplay between those two systems because it is costly. And actually, nurses, if they're doing any volunteer work with children, maybe on the hockey league or anywhere else, some of them are having subjected to 5 or 6 criminal backgrounds checks. So we think in the interest of trying to create simplicity and less duplication in our government services, we should look at that. Second of all, I just want to say that we thought the standards were different than the current 245, so we're going to need to do some further analysis of that. It looks like there's look-back periods in 245. I didn't see them. Ms. Brecken says they are there. I think it's going to. I would like to see a side-by-side because, again, I think this is confusing for nurses who are undergoing having offense. Lastly, we do not agree with the section, the last section in the bill, subdivision 15, that calls for a process to put into place fingerprinting for all current license holders. We do believe this is an unnecessary intrusion for nurses who may have been practicing for many years. And we think because of all the different applications in the law now, we should have been able to catch those folks. But the question we have to ask to policymakers is, if you have been working for 30 years and they do catch you in one of the crimes listed in 118, which is complete disqualification, should you have an ability to appeal and be rehabilitated to go back to work? I think that is a serious policy question that should be looked at as well. So thank you, and we'd be interested in working with Ms. Brecken and the DHS Licensing Division to try to frame up how do these two play together before we would pass this law. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. George. And members, I'm thinking at some point it would be really good if we had some sort of Department of Health, Department of Human Services presentation about, I mean, this whole issue of criminal background checks comes up over and over again, and there are many different types of background checks mm-hmm. and who they apply to and how many apply to them and at what point. That might be a good kind of overview for us as we deal with more and more of these issues. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your comments, Ms. George. Members, I'm not seeing any questions. That's probably good. Ms. George will be here if you have additional ones as we wrap up on the bill. But we do have another testifier, Mark. Is it Hasse? Very good. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hasse. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hasse, H-A-A-S-E. I'm vice president of the Council on Crime and Justice, which is a local nonprofit that, among other things, does policy-related work to help Minnesota build a stronger and safer community through good policy reform, criminal justice policy reform. We're also a member of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which is a coalition of over 50 organizations that have come together because all those organizations see that we have a great problem in this state, which is the fact that we needlessly cut people's potential short by passing legislation and doing other things that doesn't allow them to have a second chance when it's appropriate. And I'll say particularly, I'll keep my remarks brief. I appreciate that we may have more time to comment on this later. From the Council on Crime and Justice perspective, we're not against background checks. There are many situations when background checks should be done. And that will keep us safer in many situations. So we're not necessarily against this idea here, but the way it's done, we are against. And the primary problem with this is the permanent disqualification part. There's a list of crimes that says that somebody who has done something in the past, that a legislature has decided to categorize in a certain way, can never do something else in the future. And I think that all of you believe that people can change and people deserve to move on from their past when it's appropriate. A couple of things that I want to clarify. One, I am concerned that this bill may apply to juveniles, although it was incorrectly stated that juvenile records are sealed. Not all juvenile records are sealed. If a juvenile is charged with a felony at 16 or 17, that's a public record. The way this bill is worded, it says a conviction is a could be otherwise found guilty. That could be in the juvenile court where a judge makes a finding of guilt. Also, I want to, as you've heard, there are many positions where somebody doesn't have to go through a 245C background study, working in a private clinic. And, you know, I said I'd keep it short, so let me just, I'll just end with a story. This would be a hypothetical, and this would be about somebody who would be affected by this current legislation the way it's currently written. Let's call her Julie. Julie grew up in North Carolina. Although I don't know North Carolina's laws, there are many states that have more permissive laws around background licensing. Julie got in trouble when she was 19 or 18. She was in a relationship with a drug dealer. She got convicted of second-degree drug distribution. She then cleaned up her life, served her sentence, went on and got a nursing license in North Carolina. She's been working in a hospital for, let's say, 10 years. She married Joe, who's in the Air Force. Joe gets transferred to Minnesota in the recruiting office. Julie comes with him. Now she can't be a nurse in Minnesota anymore. So I don't think that you want to do that to Julie. I don't think that's the intent here. I don't think that's the intent of the Nurse Licensing Board, but that's what's happening here right now, and so I appreciate Representative Abler's suggestion to have this looked at more closely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hossie. Seeing no further discussion, Representative McElfatrick, do you...
Mr. Chair, just in closing, I certainly appreciate the discussion that occurred here today. As Representative Abler stated, you know, the Board of Nursing's primary role is protection of the public. And to do that job well, we do have to have the kinds of tools that allow us to determine whether or not an individual has the right qualifications, the right ethical background to be a nurse. The intent was, all along has been to really focus on those crimes that are permanent disqualifications to work now. The others really deal with, can be dealt with on a case-by-case basis and reconsideration. The one exception, and Mr. Hossie did identify it, and that's number 13 that's listed in the list, and the board would certainly be amenable to moving that to the list of those that can be for reconsideration. Murder in the first degree, kidnapping, rape, no. Those are not crimes that the board believes are amenable to rehabilitation and individuals who work with very vulnerable patients. I thank you for the opportunity to meet with you. We'll be back, and I certainly do look forward to the Nurses Association and Mr. Hossie and others providing the board with input that strengthens the bill and makes it safer for citizens in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Bragan. Yeah, I think we all share the goal of safety and security for our patients in the state, and I want to thank Representative McElfatrick and yourself for working on this bill together. And obviously, there's a little more work left to do on it, but it sounds like everybody's willing to contribute, and appreciate your flexibility on that. Representative McElfatrick, you have an amended motion to make, I think, on your bill now.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 1087, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law without recommendation.
Very good, and we vote on that, correct? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. And the motion prevails, and House File 1087 is, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Civil Law without recommendation. Thank you. Next bill is House File 1138, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1138 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
There is no author's amendment. I don't see any other
Mr.
amendments.
Chair.
Yes,
actually,
Representative
I'll describe the bill, and actually there's an amendment that should have been, we just neglected to do it. It's my fault. In the author's amendment on the floor, I got some technical assistance without endorsement, which is what the department is helpful at, about how to make this work better. And we've discussed this anyway, and so it's getting late. And I'll tell you the purpose of the bill, and I'm going to actually ask if you could just lay it over till tomorrow, and we could take it off the table and just put that amendment on and send it off. The point of this is to reduce the adversarialness that happens at counties when there's a change in service level, and this has created a lot of good discussion, and I have a suspicion that it'll change even further in the conference process. But this is enough of a worthy discussion that I'd like it to go on its own so people can know to just even be more focused on it. The point is, right now, if you don't like your change in service level, you have to. If you don't know who to call, you go to an appeals hearing with a judge, and it's and maybe it's by phone, but it's still intimidating. It's the judge may actually approve way more treatment than you even need, because sometimes they go beyond that. And if they don't get it approved, they have to actually pay for what the services they got in the meantime. So they might discontinue care, and then have to pay for it if they don't get it approved, or they did get it approved and they didn't get the care. And it seems like if you can have a step in between where you have, or you're required to have a chat at the county and say, what's all this then? So that's the point of the bill, and with that, I just kind of lay it over then till tomorrow.
We have two testifiers here. I think, you know, if we could take testimony, I think that would be fine.
I didn't know that. So.
And then we will lay the bill over.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Welcome to the committee.
Sorry.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We represent children and adults with lifelong and significant disabilities across our state. And we do understand that Representative Abler's bill is very well-intentioned in trying to get a process for people to resolve their differences prior to appeal. However, we cannot support the bill, and now that we know it's going to be amended to be the language of the omnibus bill, is that, we still have the same problems. The bill takes what is now a voluntary conciliation process for people only with developmental disabilities and makes it a mandatory step to appeal a reduction, denial, termination. And the consequence of this, well, there are several, but one certainly is it's going to be much more complicated for recipients. Far and away, most people who are affected by a decision, cut or whatever, don't appeal today. It's a daunting process for people. And this puts another process in the way of doing that, and we're concerned. Secondly, we have found that people who have case managers with the given process we have do talk to them and do resolve things when possible. But there are times when you can't, and even when you've talked about it and you've figured out your differences, people will still have to go through this mandatory process that they don't have to go through today. And the third reason, and so that'll lead to delay in getting a resolution. And then the third reason is that we really think this new process will cost money, and that is probably the most important reason. We know it's going to cost money at the county level. People who have PCA services don't even have a case manager at the county level for the most part. And the state will have to be giving people extra notices, will have to cover services pending appeal, which is required of due process, for a longer period of time. And I think given all of the budget problems and the cuts in services for our clients, we would prefer, if we have that money, to put it into services at this point rather than an extra process. Thank you.
Ms. Chair, and Ms. Henry did
represent
me
today,
and I really appreciate that. And I'm going to be working with them along the way on how to implement this. But I'm going to tell you that I'm absolutely stuck on the idea. We have to do things a little bit differently. We just went through I think in our spreadsheet, this is carried there. And there was a cost and then a savings. Because I think, I mean, I don't want to undo your testimony yet, but I think I'm onto something here. And I'm willing to listen to all the voices and tell me where I'm wrong. And maybe one of those voices is right here. So let's listen to them, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Abler. I'm Julie Ring. I'm the director of the local public health association, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, MACSA, and LPHA, the groups that represent counties, social services, and
public health. And actually, Ms. Henry did a nice job of laying out some of our concerns from the county perspective. Ms. Henry represents the client portion of this new step. I represent the county portion of this new step, and I think we share similar concerns about the addition of the step in the process. We've also met with Representative Abler and understand his desire to make change, and really early in session talked about our concerns about the contentious and costly appeal process for all of us in the system. At the county level, we don't believe that this step will result in fewer appeals. For folks that are interested in pursuing appeals, another step along the way is not going to deter them from doing that, and there's very little that we are in a position to say after we've performed a standard assessment that we think will satisfy them and where we'll be able to come to agreement without that process. And so from the county's perspective, we are concerned about this coming across to counties as an unfunded mandate at a time when we are all under budget pressure at every level of government. Essentially adding a step after we've performed our assessment that is not funded by anyone and is an exceptionally great addition, I think, to the PCA process, as Ms. Henry said, where we are not case managers. We essentially do an assessment on behalf of the state, and we're paid for the assessment that we do, and that's the end of our engagement with that client. For the waiver programs, there are some differences in how we do case management. As I think many of you know, we've talked about the fact that there were changes passed in law that are leading us down a path in the state toward a standardized assessment tool, a single assessment across all the waivers in PCA. The goal of that was really to provide more statewide standardization so that there would be more consistency across the state and from assessor to assessor. We also have a concern that adding a step like this after using that consistent tool may go the opposite direction in leading us toward less consistency across the state. And so for those reasons, we will continue to talk to the author about our concerns, but our primary concern is the additional cost to counties. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony.
Chair, just in closing,
Representative Abler.
And I have a high regard for the counties. And if you notice the bill we passed out of our finance Health Finance Committee, it left the county funding largely intact in an effort to assimilate some of this work. And I want to remind counties who I have a high degree of respect for, and the recipients and the advocates and the providers, the world cannot stay the same. And if you look at the package we're trying to provide, and I'll predict at the end there'll be a little less money available per person to serve them than the forecast calls for. I could almost guarantee that. The governor did that in his bill. We echoed part of that, although we were able to fund quite a bit of that in ways and means to have a high level. But I think that the combination of what you heard from Lutheran Social Services, where they do their service coordination, maybe on a smaller pot of money, where people become more comfortable with a move toward independence, which is also part of what everybody wants to get them toward, where they can be independent. I just met a family today, and they're never going to be independent. The cerebral palsy is a tough one. But some of the other ones, they can become more independent. So this is all part of a package. And so with that, and I'm going to work with everybody, at the end, we want to soft land as many people as we can and even add people into the system. So there's 4,000 people on the waiting list that have problems just as bad as those who are in now. So that's my goal, and maybe now we can lay it over if everybody, unless the members want to chat about it, I'll stand for discussion or lay over, whatever you pick.
Well, Member Sinas, we will be discussing this again. I think we're probably good laying this over. So House File 1138 is laid over. My intent would be to take it up tomorrow. Representative Abler, stay right where you are, because the next bill is 1185, your bill.
Mr. Chair, and this is another one of those provider contracting works in progress, and I'd like to move House File 1185 be recommended to pass and go to Commerce. The reason that you're not having a long list of witnesses, there will be one, I think Mr. Bartsch is going to come talk. And the reason that some of the other advocates went home, it's getting late, but also they didn't need to stay. Because well-intended good parties on both sides of the aisle can work out a lot of these things. But sometimes just the stimulus, not of the lobbyists, not of the people who work here, but the stimulus of a piece of moving legislation on the staff back home, on the CEOs and those people, they go, ooh, we better pay attention to this. And it gives a fair level playing field to this process. This has two provisions talking about provider contracting. And it has to do with changing the notifications about when some changes are made and also when you can do your billing are in progress even as we speak. And Mr. Barch, if you're here. Oh, yeah, you want to come sit by me. And he's going to testify about that, and then I'm going to talk about a second topic, and then I'll be done. And we'll stand for questions.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Abler. Mr. Barch, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barch. I'm here today representing Medica. I'll be very brief. I just want to echo some of the comments that Representative Abler made. The original legislation amends two pieces of law that were enacted on last year. It was an agreement between a group of providers and the health plans to change some of the contracting processes. When those changes went into effect at the first of this year, and I think right now we're just in the process of making sure everyone understands the implementation of those changes so that we can move forward. So thanks to the ongoing conversations and our work with the chairman, I think we hope to resolve any differences or confusion in this process hopefully relatively soon. And so with that, I'll end my testimony, but would be happy to answer any questions.
Do you want to say the term Chair Grunhagen before I do? Or
That's out of order.
Oh, my heavens. I have a real short fuse. I have an amendment I'd like to move, and then I'm actually going to withdraw it. But the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move it just to get it before us. There's a lot of changes going on, and one of the changes that's occurring, since I'm going to withdraw it, I'm not going to go into much detail about it, but there's a novel practice about assessing providers and patients' administrative costs, which I think is far beyond the intent of our current HMO practice and what the Commerce Department intends. And to me, this is extremely controversial. And if I would burden you with the discussion, it's getting late, but you would find it to be shocking, at least, and maybe find it other than that, at levels that range to incredibly high numbers. And this is going to be discussed later this week with some people that are reflective of it. I'm not going to burden you with the names of the groups. I'm not going to burden you with gassy stories about the numbers, but they're remarkably high admin rates, and I'll be happy to tell you privately off the tape and not if we're on TV or not. But the purpose of our work, Mr. Chair and members, is to find ways to make the system work better and be fair and equitable. And that's what I'm about here, and so I'm going to work on this some more, and I'll let you know how it worked out. If you see an amendment on the floor, sometime you'll know it didn't go as well, but I think we can resolve it privately, and so with that, I'd like to withdraw the A1 amendment, and I'll stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please don't rule me out of order.
No. He's a powerful guy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, thank you. I'd be real interested in the gassy discussions that happen about the A1 amendment. And
sure.
So, I'd love to come, or you can fill me in later, but I'm curious, and I'd love to learn more.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that the House File 1138 is not amended, be recommended to pass, and be... Oh, no, that's the wrong one, whatever one it was. 1185, be recommended to pass and be sent to Commerce.
Okay, with that, I see no additional questions. I'll call for the vote.
Aye.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. House File 118 is recommended, is referred to the Commerce Committee.
Actually,
1185.
Those glasses aren't working so good, Mr. Chair.
Pardon?
Nothing.
Okay. Okay, the next bill is House File 912.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 912 be sent to the be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. I don't know if Mr. Kerber is still here, if he's but anyway, Mr. Chair, let me just discuss the bill, and I have no amendments. And it was discussed earlier, but I'll it's a good enough idea. It deserves a credit of its own notoriety. So there's a circumstance where a person would set up a child care in their home, which works great. Reps and friends have told us that people start on their, they have 0 to 5 year olds, and won't this be great, and get to know my child, and they actually stay in the business. And then the child becomes 16, and then they find that it's a little irritating to come home to find a daycare in their house. And so what this would do would allow, I got technical assistance from the department about this to make it work, although they're not officially endorsing it. But they do have, oh, he's still here. Maybe Mr. Kerber wants to come out and just talk about the issues that come up. Because there's actually kind of there's a bright side to this, which I didn't even anticipate. But the situation is this. So now they have a nice daycare going. They have 10 kids or 14 children. If they have two people working there, and they've just kind of outgrown the house. And sometimes the requirements of houses are very minimal. As long as you sheetrock the basement, have a fire alarm, the stairway, you're pretty well good to go, and there's toys and obstacles and knives and whatever. And so this would allow somebody under home license to go to a non-home site, like a strip mall or a safe office with fire alarms and, you know, safe features, and set up the same kind of a child care. It would, that's the point of it. And the surprising finding was, talking to Mr. Kerber, that the highest number of incidences of maltreatment, if I get this right, were of minors in the home mal-infracting, what's the term, on these the daycare kids. Can I yield to Mr. Kerber and get it straight? But the point is, this actually is safer. So, Mr. Chair, could I ask Mr. Kerber to tell you what a better version of what I just tried to say?
Sure. Ms. Kerber, why don't you identify yourself to the committee?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division of the Department of Human Services. And when Representative Abler approached me to talk about this bill, he was asking, are there any upsides to this? And so it was at that point that I said, well, you know, there are some situations that we encounter in family child care that are somewhat disturbing that maybe could be avoided with this. And specifically, I have 2 years worth of data here, and the numbers are not enormous, but the situations are enormous. In 2009, we issued 18 temporary immediate suspensions of licenses. And let me just step back. A temporary immediate suspension is the most serious licensing action we can take. We do revocations, and we do fines, and we do all kinds of actions. But a temporary immediate suspension means that the provider is immediately shut down. They have appeal rights, but they come after closure of the service or termination of that service. And so we reserve that for those cases where there's imminent danger to somebody who is receiving services. And so in family child care, in 2009, 18 of those temporary immediate suspensions were based on some kind of sexual contact or indecent exposure by a household member. And so it was of those 18, in 16 of them, it was a minor child of the license holder who had some kind of inappropriate sexual behavior with kids in care. And in two of the cases, it was an adult household member. In 2010, unfortunately, we went further that direction, where there were 26 cases where there was some kind of sexual activity that was inappropriate with the kids. So we had to take an immediate suspension action. And in 9 of those cases, an adult household member was involved in the incident. And in 17 of them, it was a child of the family child care provider. And so the comment I had made to Representative Abler was, when he said, well, wouldn't it be nice if a 16-year-old didn't have to come home to family child care? In some cases, yeah. I mean, for some other reasons as well, maybe. And I'm not trying to paint that all 16-year-old boys. I've got one myself, and I wouldn't think he would do this. But, you know, we don't want to think this is going to happen, but unfortunately it does happen. And so there is a slight upside to some of this.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I do have it on good authority that infracting is a word, so they were good okay. Here, so I'm happy to be rescued on that. So we'll stand for questions. That's all.
Thank you for that point of information. Is there any discussion on the bill? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate what you're trying to do. I guess I'm wondering, while we may make it easier, the process unless you require people that have children that are 16 to do something like this, everyone's going to assume that their child is not going to, or any member of their family is not going to be the one that will malinfract, as you said. So,
we have a new lexicon coming here.
Yes. So, while it's not that I don't support the effort that you're trying to make, I'm not sure until something happens that you are going to think you're the one that's going to need this sort of service. So, I guess I just raise that.
Mr. Epson Norton, no, that's just a side effect of it. We don't. This is not a way to. To take some family who's at risk to have it not be at risk. It's just a side effect of it. So when it's amazing. I didn't even know the data until I talked to Mr. Kerber for technical advice, and he says, "Oh, by the way," and then all this infraction discussion we talked about, malinfraction. You know, that's good. But the benefit is not the highest incidence of these kinds of episodes comes from the older kids coming home from school and they're bored or they do something bad and they never would even have been and now, as you know, what we talked about in one of the last bills about all these background things and Moose Lake and all, now some of these people are ruined for life, which at least this way they never got in a situation that they never would have otherwise got in, and that's the only minor part. The point of the bill is to let the people enjoy their home while still having this business that's safe. And that's the point of it. And so they have the same background studies, the same review by the county, the same everything they ever do. It's just about where they can do it at. And it turns out, by coincidence, it's actually maybe even a safer site, but even more safe for the users of it. So that's the... There's refraction, too, but that's a different... if a person does it again, anyway, I'm stopping now. Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Okay, Representative Norton.
No, I guess, as I said, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but unless you're going to encourage people to take advantage of this, then it won't do any good. So.
Whatever.
That's
yeah, cool.
Okay.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that I think there's another side effect in that sometimes communities themselves would prefer that the child care be in a place located outside of a community, right outside that immediate community, because of traffic, a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. And there have been requests. There are numbers of child care providers who have thought this would be an interesting idea, who would like to do it, and would like to be close to their home and have the opportunity, however, to locate their child care in a place that would meet all the requirements and yet be in a place that's right out, you know, maybe more accessible and outside of their immediate home location. And we've had the requests, particularly in Plymouth and some other suburban areas.
White hat.
Representative Adler, any response?
Unless there's more questions, I can renew my motion that the House File 912 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Any further discussion, members? If not, those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for all the bills today.
House File 912 is recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Okay. There you go.
Okay, members, we had one more bill today, and it is actually being heard right now in the Senate, 1166, House File 1166. So what I'm going to do is lay over that bill, or we just won't take it up today, and we will move it to the list for tomorrow, and we'll let us all go. And there be nothing else before the committee this evening? We also want to mention that House File 1236, Representative Hamilton's bill, pharmacy audit bill, is going to be rescheduled to a later date. So in a sense, 1166 can kind of replace that one, but it's going to be moved to another date. We'll be meeting from 2:30 to 4:15 tomorrow and then reconvening at 6 p.m. here in room 200 so we can get through the bills we need to get through yet. With that, members, we stand adjourned.